Let's do it to it. I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 281st installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight, we are talking about the two-episode premiere of the final season of Star Trek Discovery. That includes both Season 5, Episode 1, The Red Directive, written by Michelle Paradise herself, the showrunner, and directed by Olatunde Osunsanmi, the producer of directors. So the big head honchos. And then Season 5, Episode 2, Under the Twin Moons, written by Alan McElroy and directed by Doug Arianokoski. I think I got his name right. He's been, both of them, I think, have been with the show since Season 1. So that'll be a lot of fun to talk about with my good friend Dave, who's joining me tonight for the last voyage on the Disco. This is it.
Yeah, that's weird. I mean, you know, we've got some episodes left, but yeah, the voyage has
we've
set
started.
Sail.
The ship has, yeah, it's set sail. It's gone to warp. The spore drive effect has begun. The nacelles have started spinning around.
How about this, Fathery? So. I shall follow your lead. That's my best saru.
I didn't know we were going to dance, but I'm here for it. Before Dave and I start cutting rug, I'm going to give a big thank you and shout out to the Text Trek Patreon supporters who make the weekly live show possible, so thank you so much. Starfleet Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Daw, Geek Filter, Quarks Bar, Stephanie Durantes, Matthew Averett, Braxton, Chuck A, Joel Valisuk, Benginium, and our anonymous supporters. Just a little bit of announcements. We will be celebrating with our patrons, per tradition, in a few days. If you're watching this live on Friday, it'll be next weekend, but on Saturday, April 13th, we are going to be watching Star Trek III, The Search for Spock in the Patreon watch party. A bit of a special occasion. That movie is turning 40 years old, and it's not a super common favorite Star Trek movie, but it happens to be my personal favorite Star Trek movie. So that'll be a fun celebration. Not only is the movie turning 40 this year, but I also have a birthday this week. So it'll be like a celebration of multiple often flawed, misunderstood, but still kind of cool things that were created in the 1980s.
You know, Star Trek III also has Christopher Lloyd's strangling a giant worm, so...
Yeah. yeah, it'll be fun. And it's always a great group who shows up in the Patreon watch party crowd, and I always look forward to hanging out with them. So that'll be fun, April 13th. And you can come into the Patreon as well as $2 a month. That'll get you into the monthly watch parties. There's additional perks as well if you can afford to be more generous, so please check that out if you are interested in supporting the show. And please also subscribe on YouTube and rate us wherever you listen to podcasts. It does help, so thank you for all the responses we get. I know, like, when I ask, I see the little meter on Spotify you know, move up. It still hasn't gotten to 4.7, so I need some more 5 stars. I feel like it should always stay at 4.7 or higher. So, and Apple Podcast as well. If we get some 5 stars there, that'd be great. But nothing really else in the way of news. So I think, Dave, we should just go ahead and delve on into the Red Directive.
We have a huge amount of material to cover. So yeah, I'm ready for it.
Yeah. So our Season 5 premiere, and this is a fun thing, Dave. I don't know if you saw this, but showrunner Michelle Paradise spoke to SFX magazine about Star Trek Discovery about a month ago, I guess, around the same time as the South by premiere. They put out this issue that had a lot of Discovery stuff in it. And one thing she did was gave like a little teasery description of each episode. And the one that she gave for the Red Directive was, she said, launching the mission. The mission is a Red Directive, an exciting mission that launches us onto our season. It's super secret. So she didn't want to give much away.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be fun to tease these as we go into each episode. So maybe I'll end tonight's show with Michelle's tease of episode 3. But the official synopsis for Red Directive was...
Father, I have to quick ask, can we have a black alert for the Red Directive?
Yeah, a lot of cut. Well, there's a lot of red in Discovery, you know.
That's true.
We have the red matter in season, or no, red matter is the Kelvin movies. We have the red angel,
right.
And we have the red bursts. Now, Picard had the red door that Jack Crusher was seeing when he had the red eyes.
The legacy of J.J. Abrams. Yeah, it's even though he doesn't do the shows, his redness has crept in.
Well, one of his writers is doing them, so maybe
it was a thing.
The official synopsis for Red Directive is, Captain Burnham and the crew of the USS Discovery are sent to retrieve a mysterious artifact hidden inside a 800-year-old Romulan vessel. What, shouldn't that be an 800-year-old Romulan vessel? An 800? I think that, because 8 begins with an E.
Yeah, I think so. So but every once in a while, there's some weird exceptions, and I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, but anyways, the synopsis writer on here put inside a 800-year-old Romulan vessel, but find that they're not the only ones on the hunt. Meanwhile, Saru is offered the position of a lifetime. So Saru gets offered a promotion, or I guess not even a promotion, a new job as an ambassador of multiple worlds. But they also find the long-lost diary of Dr. Villick, a background extra from a TNG episode, which I thought was kind of a clever way to tie this in. Just be like, oh yeah, he's this Romulan standing in the back, you know, but they basically find the diary of like one of those people standing around at the end of the TNG episode, The Chase, where they find out the secret origins of humanoid life in the Star Trek universe.
They found the Grail diary from Indiana Jones 3, basically.
Yeah, and it conveniently happens to be a member of a society obsessed with secrets and security. So if you ever needed a lot of mystery type of puzzle solving, treasure hunt type quest that'll have booby traps and all kinds of peril and danger and weird trials to put your characters through, it's like, oh, a Romulan who's saw something like really cool and valuable. That's actually a great opportunity to use the Star Trek universe. Use the canon. Use all these decades of lore and tell a cool new story with it. So
you know, in those Dan Brown books, it was the Catholic Church and like Da Vinci Code and all that. So the Romulans fill in for the Catholic Church for purposes of this show.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder how much overlap. I want to compare and contrast the Catholic Church with the Star Empire now. But that'll be like 1 year when there's not a lot of new Star Trek coming out, and we're like desperate to come up with like topics each week.
Yeah, we'll do a deep dive. We'll do research and make footnotes and shit.
Dave, why don't you give the first opening statement of the last season of Star Trek Discovery, and let's know your general thoughts on Red Directive before we discuss it in more detail.
I can do this. This is our the treasure hunt season I've been bracing for with the big venturesome aspects, and I'm glad that now that I can at least speak about having, because we had seen the first one a little bit earlier, and we knew a bit about it, and I was terrified for a few weeks that I would accidentally spill something from it, but I think we kept all the stuff properly secret. So, you know, I think my biggest complaint with it, which, by the way, I like this episode. I'm just going to say, though, my biggest complaint was the thing that I knew from the trailers was going to bug me in advance. It was Burnham's big action sequence riding Locke and Maul's ship. You know, we got it in context here and all of that. But I actually ended up kind of liking it more in context. There's an infectious energy to the episode in general. And I like the way it happened because did that trap that ejected her into space. And then she's just like, well, screw you, I'm going to get on your ship then. and then I was kind of like, oh, I like that turnaround, even if I thought she was still a little too flippant during it. But then we've got all the big action adventure stuff in the episode before, you know, there's character stuff too, but, and I was really kind of on board it. I like Maul and Locke. They've got a Bonnie and Clyde thing going on and mystery about them. I was straining credulity at the big Sandrunner avalanche chase sequence, but as a sometime fan of Fast and Furious movies, I have to admit they kind of caught the good vibes of that, the outrageousness that they do, very knowing outrageousness in those movies. And, you know, I liked all of that stuff, too. I even liked Burnham and her little commando insertion team onto, not Locke and Maul's ship, the Romulan ship, where they're all, you know, guns drawn and going through and clearing rooms and stuff like that. And so mixed in with that, we had all the character stuff. I thought, you know, the episode reminded me why I like these people, because I could feel that sadness hanging between Burnham and Book when it felt like maybe they're done. And I loved Saru and Tarina's scene, and even Tilly's awkward flirting with that one guy, although I don't know where that's exactly headed. But I'm, you know, I'm happy that she seems to be drunkenly happy. That's go for it, Tilly. In this first episode, I was trying to figure out if Captain Shaw, where he was going to land for me. Or not Captain Rayner, because I'm confusing him, because there's attrition of Shaw and like Jellicoe and all that. And he's, and these are both people, they're all people I like, and I need them to distinguish them. And we'll talk more about that, I think, in the second episode. For this first one, he was, you know, he was in that cranky place, and, like, he is definitely a fly in the ointment for our characters. But, you know, I saw promise in him and all that. And so I was along for this ride. I thought it gave me a lot to work with. That there was big action adventure stuff. There were character beats that I liked. No major issues because I knew this was going to be the action adventure scene. So or action adventure season. So that's where I am right now. That was a good, you know, buzzy first start. How about you, Fathery?
Yeah, I'm trying to separate my feelings of the first episode from the second episode.
Right.
I think the first one does a really good job of priming us for the season. Everyone I talk to comes out of the first episode excited to see what happens next. And I think a big part of that is just by giving us so much of the mystery up front. You know, they tease us with the mystery box. They have a literal mystery box in the first episode. And you know what they do? They open it. And they explain to us the situation. Yeah. So we're not so much waiting for a big reveal. You know, I talked about this when I talked about my feeling coming out of the South by Southwest premiere a few weeks ago. But, you know, I'm not on the edge of my seat waiting for explanations. There are a few mysteries I'm curious about. But as far as, like, the main story, I'm on the edge of my seat waiting to see what happens next, you know? At the end of this episode, when Michael says, let's fly, it's like, yeah, like, let's go to this twin moon planet and see what's there. You know, let's see what's going on in episode two. So it's also a really great format for, I think, serialized storytelling. You know, we talk about this a lot, Dave, when you can do these stories that not only move a larger arc along, but can have some identity as a self-contained,
sure,
you know, its own thing. So, you know, we always love that hybrid format of, like, the episodic and serialized storytelling format. So I think season five is definitely going to, well, I can't say definitely because they made this promise before, but I guess it's a second attempt to deliver on the promise of season two, which I think that was kind of the idea at some point during the writing of season two, was with the red burst, be like, okay, we have to go to each one of these things, but in each one we'll go to, and it'll be a different kind of standard Star Trek Planet of the Week type episode, but it'll move our larger plot along. So I'm excited to see all of that. And this is also the best Discovery has ever been at using the universe, like I was talking about earlier. So that's just within, like, one episode, but just, like, the Soong android, the Romulan science vessel, just, like, some of the stuff we got in episode two that we'll talk about in a second. But it's, like, Discovery has learned from Strange New Worlds and Picard, I think, a lot, and just, like, oh, it can be, like, really advantageous. You know, we ran to the 32nd century to get away from canon and do our own thing, but now that we've been here a couple of years and we've established our own identity and we know what we're doing, we can to pull in as much of that stuff as we want. And it's more of like they're selectively using the universe. And so I think they're able to work with it a little bit better. You know, you're not having, like, the same type of conflicts you're having in season one, where you're like, oh, we want the show to look, like, really slick with, like, cool holograms when they're communicating. But, like, we also want it to be like this 23rd century type, you know, prequel to the original series. And, it, you know, we don't have those types of conflicts right now. So I'm excited to continue the ride.
You're liking the identity that they've established?
I am. I like
32nd century.
The identity that Discovery probably always had, but has just now discovered.
Well, maybe that's the big discovery of the season. Yeah, Father, you mentioned the reveal of what the thing is, and I think we can say at this point, you know, with the, we'll dive into it more later, that it has to do with the progenitors. And
we can call them that in canon now. That was kind of like an expanded universe thing.
That's right.
Like, no one had ever said that about them in anything canonical.
But that was a big thing for me, too, to kind of know that, you know, I am sure that, I mean, the exact nature of what, you know, is it Velik? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Of what he found. That's, you know, there's specifics we don't know yet. There may be some twists and turns. I suspect there will be. But the basics we know, and it's rooted in, you know, it's rooted in that Trek lore. It's funny. That was one of my, I hope we get this, top three things, was some Trek lore. But I do have some reservations about it, too. I'm going to wait till we get a little bit more deeper into it, and I'll talk about that.
Let's start with the opening of the episode. You know, it does open on the scene that, like, Dave was complaining about since they showed it in Comic-Con of Michael riding on Maul and Locke's ship. But I always told him, I was like, Dave, this is probably going to happen in the first episode of the season. So, you know, we'll get past it pretty quick. And it's actually like the first scene.
Yeah.
So I thought they didn't need to do this where they have Burnham on top of a ship, you know, the opening of the season, be like, oh, this is not how I thought the night was going to end. And then cut to 4 hours earlier. I think the episode does move along like really fast, and it does get to the action really fast, but I guess it is kind of funny.
There's a bit of a tried and true structure there. You know, the flashback to how you got to some crazy place. They clearly wanted to stake out their territory and say, here's what this season is about, or at least one of the big things that it's about.
I love that they're talking about the age of the Federation, and they're making like a big deal about like the Millennium Celebration, mm-hmm. when we get like that smash cut to what was going on. The idea of they had like this big 1,000-year anniversary a few decades earlier, but like Earth wasn't in the Federation, Vulcan wasn't, or Navarre wasn't in. It's like none of the like the cool kids who were there at like the beginning. I guess the Tellarites were, but like no one wanted to celebrate. They were probably someone like asked, like probably like the president probably asked, like, Tellarites, do y'all want to have a big party since you know you're the only ones who can say you've been in the Federation for 1,000 years? And they're probably like, nah, we're busy. you know, something, but just to be contrarians, but I thought that was cool that, like, you know, we saw the state of the Federation in the opening of season three. Is I was complaining about how I didn't want to see like a post-apocalyptic Star Trek, you know, so I think it's cool that, like, now we're on like the upswing. I think we spent enough time in that it's justified now that we can kind of move past that, and we'll have like the Starfleet Academy show. It's like, oh, it's like a Federation that's like, you know, it's done with, you know, it's past like that, it's returned back to the post-scarcity utopia that Star Trek's kind of supposed to be set in.
But I think they'll probably still pull a little bit on Reconstruction type era stuff, you know,
just a little bit, just like to keep their like powers and capabilities from being like too, you know, like Daniels in the 31st century seemed like almost like, you know, God mode. So they got it. Right. You got to nerf the Federation a little bit. But
That's what the Borg are there for occasionally to keep us humble.
Picard got rid of them, so they need something else.
Yeah.
What do you think of Stamets' dilemma? This is what I was trying to talk to you about like last week when I was saying like, it kind of seems like season five, you know, the stuff like at the very beginning, it does feel like they're setting up what should be the final season, you know, where you have
his legacy
characters
thing.
Yeah, like worried about like the, you know, the ends of their career.
Yeah, I, you know, it felt a little out of nowhere to me. I suppose, you know, like when you have events that are like anniversaries or holidays or birthdays and things like that, though, that can kind of push those things to the forefront. So, you know, the Federation anniversary might have had gotten him thinking about that. But it's one of those things that I'm kind of neutral on right now. It did seem a little forced to me. What about you?
I liked it, but it was also gave them an excuse to talk about, we're not going to have the spore drive on like every Federation ship. You know, we had that one prototype on Book ship that got blown up. Mm-hmm. I am sad about Book not having his ship anymore. I liked his ship, even though it never had a name, and that bugs me.
Oh, that is weird.
He never named his ship. But
what are they? Is it pathway drives or what they're calling the new?
Yeah, they're going to have whatever
standard
that's going to be. Yeah. You know, the Antares doesn't have one yet, so they're still the Voyager or Voyager, whatever it is, Voyager J. They tested it out on Voyager J, but that'll be the future. I'm sure that's what they'll be using in Starfleet Academy, and Spore Drive just will be gone. Discovery will remain one of a kind.
Now they're going to actually have to worry about travel time to places.
There's also, they set up the Tarina and Saru thing there, where Saru is worried about if he should take this job and leave Starfleet, but, you know, it would bring him closer to Tarina, and then her saying, like, oh, well, don't do it because of me. But I like that she, you know, mentioned some other... I was complaining about one of the things that they haven't really done after the Emerald Chain was set up any other, like, who are the other big bad guys? You know, who are the other superpowers in the in the galaxy? It can't just be the Federation. Mm-hmm. And then she starts mentioning, you know, Tholians and Breen. I'm like, oh, cool, I was just asking for this. So I liked that.
Yeah, yeah, there was some lore drops in there. There, you know, their courtship has been so slow, it's like... what do they call it? Like Regency era romance kind of thing. I mean, I like it. I warm to it. It's sweet.
I don't know that. I don't know Regency era.
It's I think when you get close to sort of the Jane Austen type stuff, maybe.
Okay.
But also, you know, that sort of formal, courtly sort of slow burn that they might have. I may be misrepresenting that, but yes, I like, you know, when they do talk about things like that, you know, it's clearly very important to them. You know, you can tell that they're bursting with emotion.
I liked when Vance approaches Burnham with that little infinity room thing. I guess that's just going to be whenever they need to have, like, a meeting. We're just going to go into this white room to, like, share some exposition. But that infinity room, I guess it's, like, Kovic's, like, private meeting room. But I'm glad that Kovic seems to be having, like, a bigger role in the season. You know, one of the things I was talking about last week when we were talking about the top three things we want to see in the season was use of the established recurring characters, specifically... Mm-hmm. Admiral Vance. So that was another big relief the first time I saw this episode when, yeah. Okay, 5 minutes in, I see Vance like walk onto set.
I loved his scene. It's next episode, but I think he's like picking up after his kids. It's very humanizing.
Yeah, yeah, I have some thoughts on that too. But we get like the red directive, which we don't know what that is, but you know, Michael seems to know. It means like shit is serious from this Romulan science vessel that set off this distress signal, which I guess one of my problems, I guess, with Discovery after season three is it just seems like it's kind of a coincidence that like some like all these big things keep happening after like Michael shows up and she's the first person to figure out the burn after 100 years or so. And then for some reason, just like 6 months after that, the 10C decide to start mining our galaxy, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, Saru was, you know, kind of the savior for his planet that sort of united the Ba'ul and Kelpians.
And then for some reason, the next year after that, this distress signal goes off on the Romulan science vessel. Maybe there's a reason for it, but I would love if someone could connect that. Like, maybe, like, whatever happened, like, when Michael stopped the burn, maybe that did something to, like, oh, that's why the 10C started mining boromide or something. Maybe, like, something that they turned over, it activated something on this Romulan ship or something. I don't know, but I'd rather it, like, be connected than just be like, oh, look at, like, these coincidences that just keep happening every year.
It would be nice. I guess it basically amounts to, you know, they're the heroes, they're the protagonists, they get the big missions. Or, Father, if you prefer, you may want to think that there's just as big of things going on in at least a few other major starships that, you know, some other dude is saving the galaxy in a different way.
That's what I want to believe, is that there's always, like, these big adventures happening. The Star Trek universe is just such a crazy place that there's always, like, multiple big Star Trek episodes taking place at the same time. And
right,
there's all these different Starfleet crews dealing with it.
The Romulans have a very different perspective on all of these things, although they're not around for this, but... And Locke and Maul, who are pictured here on our still frame, wearing their cool Daft Punk suits.
Yeah, what do you think when the first shot we get of Maul and Locke when they're wearing like these kind of Tron looking helmets?
Yeah, they look cool. They look cool throughout. And Maul is cute. She's hot.
One of our audience members, Joel, said in the Texrec Discord that he thought they might have been like 32nd century Breen when they stepped on board with those helmets on. I do want to see the Breen at some point in the 32nd century and what they're like. What do they got going
on? I feel like they would. They mentioned something about him in the next episode. I think we're going to get some crossover with him almost certainly. Fathery, do you know the term like from like the 1930s of Mull, like Moll? I think it's still pronounced Maul.
No, I don't know about that.
It's like a gangster's girlfriend. They sometimes call him a gun Maul. But yeah, like, you know, that's exactly what it is. And I wondered if, I mean, that almost had to have gone into their thinking to do the sort of sci-fi version of that.
We also, Maul and Locke, you also get Moloch.
Oh, interesting point. You're breaking it down the way the crazy Data
the way that,
android
yeah, Fred,
did.
Fred the android did. Yeah. I said, like, there are a few mysteries, I guess. And I guess one of them is, what's going on with Maul and Locke? Because they're kind of mysterious. They haven't given us too much about them. Although it looks like we might learn a lot in episode 3, given how episode 2 ends.
Mm-hmm. And we find out more in episode 2, for sure.
But I think Locke might be some type of, you know, some type of changeling or something. Or some slimy dude who can just take a solid form with how, like, his face was kind of morphing around when he first took off the helmet.
Oh, you know, I think I must have missed that somehow. I don't know how, but maybe I was distracted by her hair, which is very pretty. But I did
yeah, they
not...
show, like, his face morph when the helmet first comes down.
Interesting. Now, I guess that could just be, like, something his, you know, species can, like, you know, conform or change, but yeah, I don't know, like, why you call attention to it unless you're going to be a shape changer or something.
Yeah, it was. It seems that they obviously were trying to set up a mystery there.
I need to go rewatch this right now.
But I think that it's just in that one shot. They don't hint at it any other time in the two episodes that I'm aware of. But I guess they establish the two of them are, like, really into each other. But I don't know, like, I think they're pretty fun to watch, and I like the ideas of them. But their dialogue always comes off as, like, a little flat. And uninteresting.
They're a little bit like Bonnie and Clyde ciphers right now.
Yeah, they don't have their own personality.
Right, right. We see them that they're kind of slick and they got each other's back and they kind of clearly have been around the block doing this before. But there's not a whole lot. And other than that bit in, it was in this episode where he kind of freaks out when he thinks she's injured and kicks some ass. That's a pretty traditional kind of tropey thing. Not super good writing, not terrible or anything. I'd like to see more of them. I feel like, I wonder if Book is going to be our pathway to that in episodes to come. He was in the second one.
Yeah, I think he'll probably do a lot of that in episode three. What I thought was interesting about them is Kovic straight up tells Michael, like, don't worry about Stun. I don't care if you have to kill people. This is so important.
That bothered me a bit.
You to do this. But the juxtaposition of that with Maul and La'ok, where they seem fairly, like, non-lethal. They don't kill anyone. They use non-lethal weapons on Owo and Reese to immobilize them. So I think that's interesting.
You know what else, Father? They're kind of unusual in that, like, our lead couple, let's just say, Michael and Book are kind of broken up and, you know, fighting to kill. La'ok and Maul are in love and, you know, fighting just to escape. You know, I don't think that we're really meant to think that wildly that the Federation is in, you know, the wrong here or anything. I think the idea is just going to be that kind of like a Genesis device on, like, a galactic scale. They just don't want it in the hands of bad guys, and that's how important it is. But it is interesting. Yes, the bad guys are kind of sympathetic in this. They haven't done anything terrible yet. They encased her, was it Owo and stuff, in, like, some kind of little protoplasm or energy field that they couldn't get out of. They didn't kill anybody, you know. Jill notes that they killed the Sith. So they did kill one person. Although
he's clearly going to come back to life later.
Yeah,
I think so too. So I'm not too worried about that. But I was going to bring that up when we get to it. Like, yeah, they killed someone in self defense. Well, I'll talk about it more when we get to it. But that's actually going to be evidence for the case I'm making. Their weapon that they use on Michael is even, like, arguably, like, non lethal. Like, yeah, like, it sends her out into space. But, you know, as you were just saying, Dave, like, yeah, that clearly wasn't that big of a deal for her. She was more worried about her saxophone lesson than her own mortality, it seems. So,
you know, I don't know if they. I guess there's probably a lot of. Most suits probably do at least the basics of what hers does, if not as good. And, you know, that I think they're not trying to kill people.
What do you think of Rayner's introduction, though? We kind of just get, like, this voice from him, from, like, this asshole trying to take over the pursuit of these. It's kind of like a cop who's, like, on the pursuit of these perps. And he's like, what are you doing? This is my case.
For just a second, it feels like he's got her back, though. And then, like, they're just a few seconds later, they're at odds. You know, he's tangled with them before, first of all. They've slipped out of his grasp before. So, we can at least understand that to some degree. And Michael's plan does not work. They do sort of, they would have gotten away if they hadn't pulled in Book to kind of help him out, potentially. So, I don't know. Maybe he was right.
I liked his attitude, though, when he first, like, when he appears on the bridge and he's talking about the cherry they put on that shit Sunday just now when they went into warp and shot off all those decoys and we're not going to be able to find them. And I don't know. I just kind of liked how aggressive he is right off the bat. It's like, oh, hell, we're going to have to deal with this dude. So, you know, immediately there's going to be some fun, dramatic sparks with him. And then let's talk about, like, the meeting. They bring in Book and they have, like, this big meeting in the ready room. And I love seeing, like, Rayner stand in the same ready room that I saw that Captain Pike stood in, you know, hundreds of years earlier. I don't know. I just like that connection. It's like, oh yeah, Rayner, he's kind of connected to those 23rd century dudes.
To think about that way.
they are able to use Book to determine where Maul and Locke would go with their little Romulan mystery box. And then we get our desert planet Quamol, which, obviously created to be the action set piece for the Sand Riders. It's like, oh, what could we do, like, a cool effect? How about, like, these, like, hover bikes that, like, go across the desert? Yeah, okay, that'll be a good, like, action set piece for a season premiere.
You know, a kind of, also, like, that kind of old-school marketplace is total Indiana Jones vibe, you know, meant to probably prompt a little bit of, the Middle Eastern town thing. Nicely designed, by the way. They put so much detail into it on these things as they're walking through it.
I wasn't expecting the breakup between Michael and Book, and so I'm really worried about the two of them. But it was fun watching, like, them interact, and then Rainer being kind of like the third wheel, being like the...
He's like, let's just kick the door in.
Yeah.
This, you know, as a little symbol of them not being on the same page, they used to always do the, you know, remember the same maneuvers from their courier time together. Yeah. And here they're calling, they're like, oh, let's do this one. And he's like, let's do that
Rigel 5. No, we should do, but yeah, Book says Rigel 5 and Burnham says Ventar 4.
Yeah.
Which I like, because I think the only use of Ventar in Star Trek was Garak made Morn some underwear out of Ventarian wool.
Oh, interesting.
So that's a deep cut. I didn't make the Gorn eggs, but that's a fun one.
It's in there.
But yeah, it shows that they're out of sync, and at the same time, we see Maul and Locke are so in sync. And also, like, Fred's kind of description of them. I think this might be a Michelle Paradise thing, but I sometimes in Discovery, I notice this a lot in season 4, but it feels like you can feel, like, these sound like writers in a writer's room talking to each other. But the way that, like, Fred is just talking about, like, oh, y'all have such cool bad guy names, Maul and Locke. It's like, was this, like, a conversation? Like, Michelle Paradise, was this, like, a conversation, like, you had with, like, your writers? And you're just like, hey, this could be good dialogue. Let's just, like, type this up, you know? But
right, the kind of way that you might... analyze the names for, like, how it's going to sound and, you know, how it goes to the ear of people and stuff like that. He was a weird dude. It seems like people liked him. I'm kind of neutral on Fred myself. I was sort of glad when he got shot.
Oh, I liked him. I liked him a lot because of his weirdness. I like this idea of, like, the 600-year-old Soong type android, which could be a little scary, you know, like, even Noonien Soong, who made Data, you know, he also made Lore. So sometimes these things, you know, their wiring might not be laid out for the best, you know. Yeah. So
he gets to do the puzzle box thing.
Yeah, so you get to see, like, the Data, like, fast hand thing. And then and he is kind of a jerk, you know. He's like, oh, I'm gonna give you 3 bars of latinum, and, you know, we're not gonna negotiate, you're gonna get the hell out, and I'm gonna keep all your stuff. And when they're like, no, we're not gonna agree to those terms, and it's only, like, they only get, like, lethal with Fred after Fred attempts to shoot Maul. And then Locke, like, unloads on him. And yeah. I think, like, at that point, you know, it's like, it's almost like it would take a superhuman act for him not to do that. It's,
right, that was, like, that's self-defense.
She's the love of my life, and you're going to try to kill her? Like, no, that is an automatic, I'm destroying you right now, like, on instinct.
You get the shotgun.
Yeah, you get the cool emerald chain flat rectangle shotgun from season 3, bitch. And they blast them. Yeah. I like it. But and I also like Burnham coming in there and being like, oh, we should see if he has any, you know, next of kin to notify. I love that, like, in the 32nd century, like, we look out for the androids' family too.
You know what's funny to me? At first I was like, when they came in, there was like, I was like, there's 2 downed guards, and I kind of wanted them to at least, you know, run a tricorder or something over them. But I didn't get the impression that they even looked at him. And I was like, well, it's nice for the android, but because they made a point to have Burnham say, notify a next of kin, you know, if we can, and all that, their tomb raiding, and this comes up in the second episode too, is a little more thoughtful. It isn't quite the Indiana Jones, I'm going to blow your temple to pieces and not care. And so I appreciate that. And this is, I think, the first instance of them doing that. And maybe something to watch for is maybe them subverting some of those tropes a little bit. Like, we're going to try and respect the local culture and people a little bit more. But since they made a point that she wanted to check into this dude, I think we can assume that they were meant to have made just seen that the guards were knocked out or something.
I also thought that it was interesting that they made a big deal of Stamets talking to Kolber about, like, oh, I got plenty of wire. I got all this old 23rd century technology laying around. I'm a pack rat. Like, we can, you know, work on this dude. So I think he is going to come back. They got to give Stamets something to do. If they're not going to have, like, the spore drive shit as a central focus this season. So maybe he'll be on android repair.
Is Stamets, Tilly, and Deera, are they kind of all essentially our big science people right now?
And so was Saru, and so was Michael. This is the most... But Discovery's supposed to be a science ship, so it makes sense that it's all staffed by... Yeah, most of the characters on the show are science officers.
Yeah, yeah. But yes, you're right. It, like, I feel like that's those are Chekhov's wires. They will not be... They will not be forgotten, I think.
And I thought that was fun to point out, like, oh yeah, they don't, everything is wireless in 32nd century. Like, they don't even connect the nacelles to the ships anymore. Like, right, the nacelles are wireless.
Yeah, yeah, Bluetooth nacelles. I wonder what, if there's going to be any interaction if Fred comes back with Zora.
Oh yeah, we could have some AI, I'd love to see just a scene between the two of them.
Yeah.
Just, what would they have to talk about?
Well, and she's like essentially, well, she's older tech too, but also like, I feel like overall much more advanced.
Yeah, I mean, she has like all that sphere data that goes back thousands of years. So
right.
That...
It's just, yeah, it would be interesting. I'd like to see him talk.
Well, what do you think of the Avalanche Sand Runner craziness?
I was a little bit, is this going to be too much? And, you know, seeing some starships hit the dirt and kick up dirt with, I guess not so much their superstructure, but like the shielding around
the shields.
Them. Yeah, was, that is at the edge of Star Trek craziness, but they're staking out their territory, and I feel like I can work with it. I sometimes like those sort of big, wild ideas. The idea being that they, you know, science and, you know, knowing physics and being able to master physics about their ship is so good in the 32nd century, and they probably learned so much since arriving there that although it might seem crazy, they can do it, yeah.
Like, Bookship would, like, morph its, like, outside shape and do all kinds of weird stuff. Like, I think just, like, turning your ship, like, at a 80-degree angle near the ground is not that weird, but
yeah, and it's just like they stopped an avalanche with by two ships sticking their noses in front of it, and you know that's a little out there. It's a little out there. What about you, Fathery? Were you on board? At any point did you think, whoa, too much? Maybe too much?
No, but I actually don't find like the ship thing like that remarkable.
Okay.
And I'm kind of like neutral on that aspect of it, but I loved everything leading up to that. A lot of like the dialogue and stuff.
Were you pissed Rainer? Or do
no,
you think he made a fair call?
I don't, 70% chance. It's like a lot of people would probably be like, okay, 70% chance it'll be okay. I don't know, like 30% chance of like an avalanche on that village. I probably wouldn't have done that, but Rainer did it and it did work. But I think it's interesting that, like, the idea of inspiring your enemy, that becomes a thing they actually point out and seems to be it'll become a plot point in episode two. It's also a common thing in, like, Indiana Jones-type movies where it's like, oh, I'm going to have to solve this puzzle, but what if by solving the puzzle I'm actually revealing it to my enemy? You know, it's kind of an important thing in those types of stories. But what I thought was interesting was that, you know, the thing I was saying about, like, Maul and Locke, how they appear to be, like, non-lethal characters, and then here they do put the village in danger, but they do that knowing that there's two Starfleet ships present. So it's kind of like if you see Superman fly by and you throw a baby out a window, you know Superman's gonna save the baby. So I mean, it's still a pretty messed up thing to do, but you know, like, okay, there is no way that this Kryptonian superhuman is not going to see this baby, and he is going to fly here and grab this, like, this a cakewalk for him. Like, right. He can do that. So it's an interesting
but there
interesting
is
a, thing
as the case in this, it's like, well, but will Superman definitely hear it and be able to get, you know, like, you know, not be distracted or doing something else? No. Just as they, Locke and Maul, can't have known for sure about the Discovery, but, you know, in a world of kind of adventure tropes, it's probably, it doesn't cast them as total evil, I think. You know,
right,
their,
but
things
I think,
are just
I think
a little different.
And it didn't stand out that much to me the first time that I watched this episode, but after seeing episode two and Book kind of talk about how, like, oh yeah, like, they're really, like, not that bad. So it makes me think that they're going to make it a point to show them being like fairly, you know, non-lethal, like they will kill if they need to,
right.
if you back them in the corner, they'll kill you to get out. But otherwise they're not going to be that malicious. I don't know. That's just my theory, but that's, to me, it looks like that's what they tried to convey with these two episodes. We'll see if that's where it goes or not.
In fiction, there's a longstanding appreciation for thieves. gentleman thieves, roguish thieves, you know, thieves with a heart
and
of gold.
And if it's not, if that's not the take, if I'm wrong on that, I'm not even going to be disappointed. I'm not even saying, like, that's what I hope it is. Like, I'd be open to it being something different. That's just my read on it. This is how I'm reading it now off of what's been presented.
Fair.
So, but if I'm wrong, then cool. I hope whatever else it is something also interesting. But I think I'd be down for that. But I also like that they take the time to, like, show our heroes, like, saving people, because that bothers me in, like, superhero movies. Like, whenever they don't show that, like, there any superhero movie, there should be, like, some scene where, like, the hero, like, saves, like, some civilians just trying to go about their life.
Right. And when all you do is punch villains, it can almost feel egotistical and self-centered.
It's super important in that genre. It's not as big of a deal in Star Trek, but it's still something you need to show in Star Trek. You need to show that Starfleet, you know, being the heroes of the galaxy from time to time.
But I also think, Father, and now that we've kind of talked about this, I hadn't thought about it while I was watching, but they are kind of, at least in several cases, are directly doing things that sort of break from the tradition of old pulp adventure exploration movies. Make sure that the body gets in next of kin are taken care of. Make sure we protect this village. Indiana Jones never protected the cities he was in. He was kind of cutthroat and mercenary. And then in the second episode,
he had more in common with Maul and Locke than with Michael Burnham, I think.
Right. And in the second episode, they make a point they don't want to destroy the statuary that has the cool Romulan verse on it. So again, usually just collateral damage in these kind of movies. Like, you don't really think about it too much when they get.
You changed my opinion. It kind of bothered me when they were like that protective of that stuff in the second episode. But I hadn't thought about it as much as you had. After hearing you make a case for it, though, I'm okay with it. I was just thinking, like, well, that's not very realistic. Like, you know, in like real life, you know, when there's like wars and stuff, like no one cares about like sacred sites, you know. But I like that the 32nd century is just better than our real life human history. Yeah.
Every once in a while on Discovery, I find that they're like they'll pause and they'll chat a little bit too much when I feel like they should be, like, they're pressed for time. Like, you know, they're going through that forest and she and Saru are having a heartfelt conversation. I was like, y'all should probably be a little more focused on the mission, you know. And so they do. That is something that they sometimes do on Discovery. But I think we can take it to be, yes, like you said, they go out of their way to kind of, you know, interact with each other in a more humane way, even on a serious mission to not destroy and disturb things. It'll be interesting to see how that progresses through the season.
Agreed. Before we talk about the ending of this episode, after Discovery returns the dry dock, let's just talk about, like, the Tilly B story stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we see her at the party, the Millennium party at the beginning, and then she stays behind at HQ while everyone else goes have big adventure and Romulan ships in the desert and whatnot. But there's this other character, Lieutenant Jax, I've learned is his name, although it's not said in the episode, who they show. I guess he's also a teacher at the academy. They're talking about, you know, working with students and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, what do you think's going on here? You talk about, you know, watching the flirty interaction, but I think this is set up for something in the academy. Maybe he's going to be a regular on that show. Maybe they're both going to be regulars on that show. I don't know. They're keeping the casting secret so far.
You know, Father, secretly, of course, I'm hoping that I'll get that. What was one of the things that I wanted from my three things I want list, which is, you know, her bringing in one of her, like, some of her gifted students to help with, you know, like, we're the ones who are going to number crunch this puzzle or create a holographic version of something and figure it out or go on a little bit of an excursion with them. So I want that to happen. He's going to go along. There's flirtation. There's an obvious romantic interest.
They both liked the other one.
Yeah. I think I talked about this. I don't remember if it was on the last podcast or if it was off mic, but Tilly, when she was way back at the party in season one, which, you know, admittedly early in the development of the character, when she was drunk in that, she looked like she was going to, she like the kind of person who would, like, she would hook up with somebody that night if the opportunity presented itself. And she's, I was a little surprised to see her.
That's
kind of,
she was like a freshman in college then. Now she's been like a teacher at the academy for like a year.
But I wouldn't think that particular awkwardness, like, she's drunk and she should be at least somewhat loosened up like she was at the party then. She's not like, I mean, she's still in what, her 20s? You know, she's a kid still. I just thought that, you know, she wouldn't be as kind of romantically awkward around him as presented here.
I didn't even think that she was like the awkward one. I almost think it was more like he kind of was like too dense to pick up on her.
I think he's just willing to kind of play it slow.
Yeah, I think, but like, no, it felt like he was being like politely cautious.
Right, he kind of recognized that she's, you know, maybe a little too tipsy to make a fair judgment right now.
Oh, maybe that is what it was. And so, maybe I'm an asshole for not like that. I didn't factor that in.
But. So yeah, when she said when she says something about like, well, we better call it a night, and he's like, I guess we better or whatever, and you know, they're both sweet and kind of smiling about it. But yeah, like not a lot of information to go on here, but I'm interested. You know, I was like Tilly, and I want to see people if they're looking for romance, I want to see them find it.
Yeah. Jill 47 is pointing out that Mary Wiseman is 38 now. She kept her age secret when she was cast on Discovery. No, none of us knew how old she was. We all thought she was like 22.
Nope, she's still a little baby.
But I think they are writing her as like a little older.
I mean, that's definitely
in the Academy. In the Academy show, they're going to write her as a woman in her 30s, not in her 20s.
That's good. I'm for that.
But Lieutenant Jax was quite the subject of attention in the Text Trek First Reaction stream last night from day of recording. I didn't realize he was going to be so popular.
Is he the subject of primarily the gay crush?
No, it's not exclusive to the gay men. There's also a lot of straight ladies or ladies attracted to men.
I wasn't sure. I wasn't looking. Not watching. I don't have my finger on the pulse like you, Father.
But I think like in our audience, I see some people are commenting about him now.
I guess he didn't have enough time to kind of make a big impression on me one way or the other. But, you know, he seems cool. Seems all right. I trust him.
But more importantly, the stuff with Tilly and Vance, I thought was cool. They kind of bonded in that season 4 finale, you know. So I like him kind of having her back here and letting her go ahead and finish the hacking, because you know he wants to know too. He like Kovich has locked him out too. And then the actual reveal was just so damn cool, and it was amazing to be like, wow, Discovery, you had like the actual like. Screen accurate Romulan uniform, almost. You were a little embarrassed of the shoulder pads. I get it. I'd be embarrassed of those too. But you know, for the most part, like great job. I never thought I would see the 24th century Romulan, you know, science ship again. I never thought that I would. I mean, I guess the chase kind of begged to be followed up on at some point, but I don't know. It felt like a nice surprise. It was not what I was expecting, but it was like, oh, that actually really fits. That's a good choice for the type of story you seem to be wanting to do in season 5.
Yeah, I like the Vance Tilly connection. It's you know, Discovery is presenting a Starfleet, especially in the 32nd century, that's decidedly different from the Badmiral Pact Starfleet of centuries past. Even when they had a lot of good guys, you would probably not have had that kind of relationship, that sort of friendship going on.
Yeah, like Admiral Ross and Ben Sisko, like they got along, but they were never friends. They just felt like, you know, dudes who worked together and got along at work.
Yeah, and I think 32nd Century Disco is saying, hey, the workplace might look different, like with less like harsh hierarchies. Yes, there's a hierarchy, but it's not going to be imposed intensely. It's not going to be demeaning if you're on the lower end of the hierarchy or anything like that. And also, of course, they do, you know, Tilly is an asset to them. They see her as like a key person, I think. Was it Kovich who helped place that, or was that Vance?
Kovich is the one who brought her to the Academy.
Yeah. So okay. So when Kovich speaks, people listen. They know that she's something of a linchpin of their next generation. So.
Do we want Kovich explained, or should he always be like this level of mysterious? He's okay with like lethal force, but he's also like, oh, but he cares enough about like cadets learning like the good Starfleet values that he was the one who wise enough to install Tilly at the Academy.
Right. And he was a thoughtful sort of judge for Zora's trial of sorts.
Yeah.
You know, early on, I think I wanted them to explain him, and now I think I don't necessarily. But it is kind of weird to have somebody with that level of power, because it speaks to Section 31 type thinking. You know, when people don't even know where somebody is exactly in the hierarchy, that's a little bit weird.
It's fun, dramatic storytelling to have him as this mysterious entity, but I think, yeah, I wouldn't want that in my society. I wouldn't want to be like, well, I guess in order for us to be safe, we have to have like these secret, powerful guys like Kovich that can, you know, that can operate without any type of accountability in the shadows, you know. So yeah, I agree with you on that, but it is fun. Maybe there's a way to strike the right balance with that. But I loved the visualization of the Discovery returning to dry dock with all of that radioactive sand on it, but then the camera pulls back. We see Tarina watching out of a window, and then Saru beams from Discovery to be right next to her, all within one shot. It was just cool to be like, oh yeah, your ship is pulling up, and then you just tap your chest and boom, you're like, you're like inside next to your girlfriend, you know? It's like,
it's pretty convenient. Cool. People don't like the long travel times, or have you ever been walking your ass all over an airport? Pretty dope. By the way, is that the Archer's space dock?
We can assume it's like the same CGI model. So yeah. I think that's the intent.
Is this is where he's talking at this point about the job, and she, right? And she's
this is
like,
this is when she proposes.
Oh, okay. That's back. When that comes up. Okay, that was, I wasn't that sure was if that was in the second.
Yeah. Well, he tells her like, I've made my choice. That's kind of cool. I didn't think about that till now. But Dave, Tarina does not propose until Saru tells her that he already made his choice to take the job and to live at Starfleet HQ, and they would be, you know, living and working close to each other. After he's already made that choice, then she proposes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of stuff in there. I noticed she used the love, the L word, early on. My favorite bit in this, I think this was the first episode, was when she was asking him what's on his mind, and she kind of playfully puts her hands up near him, like she's like, "Am I going to have to mind meld it out of you?"
A playful Vulcan.
And it was like, rare to see like someone as reserved as her be that sort of playful.
That's something that, you know, Vulcans wouldn't have acted like in, you know, the 23rd or 24th century, but they clearly change over time. And you know, if the Romulans move back in to the planet, that's probably going to have some, I don't want to say cultural contamination, but we'll just say some cultural blending. And maybe Vulcans are just in general loosened up. We still see more rigid Vulcans on Discovery too, so it's not all of them. But I think Tarina is probably a bit more representative of the typical Vulcans of the 32nd century. Maybe the Academy, maybe we'll have a young Vulcan cadet.
They should for sure have a Vulcan in there. Father, there's a bit, I forget the name of the actress who plays Tarina, but when Saru says, you know, he's like, Discovery is my home and my family, and you're also my home and my family, and you're more. And like, her, she's looking up at him, and they're just eyes locked, but her mouth twitches a little bit with emotion, and I always love subtle facial acting.
And Doug Jones is actually able to do a bit more physical acting. They changed the Saru prosthetics in season 5. They use a thinner latex. And he talked about in an interview recently how he's actually able to be a bit more expressive in his face. And I didn't notice it that much the first time I saw the first episode. But when I saw the second episode and I see him like running around like out in the daylight and some natural lighting and some of the location stuff, it's like, oh yeah, Saru's face has never looked this good. It was pretty clear to me then, but I think a lot of their scenes are good. They have good chemistry in general. I feel like that this romance they only did because these two actors had the good chemistry. And one of the things I wanted to see this season is a wedding, or not necessarily a wedding, but just like a happily ever after. I just want to know, like, these two people are going to be together the show is over, but they're together and they're happy. And I don't know if that needs to be Book and Burnham, or it needs to be Adira and Gray, or if it needs to be Saru and Tarina, but I would like to see a wedding. We haven't had like a big like wedding of established, you know, regular characters, kind of like a Jadzia and Worf or a Tom and B'Elanna type wedding. It's not been done in a while. We're due for one.
I think these are the two. I think they're the two. It's a little too early, I think, for Gray and Adira.
They're young.
I feel almost certain that Michael and Book will get back together, but I kind of respect.
I'm worried. I'm worried about.
Yeah, I respect, and maybe, and I'm a little worried too, because they showed a pretty real moment when they realized that maybe it's over, and I think they're gonna take something from Locke and Maul ultimately, and that may be what helps that happen again. But until then, I think Tarina and Saru are the ones to beat. They should get the wedding. Yeah. And
Serena's his sister, so hopefully that's not who he's marrying.
That's true. You know, Father, I just wanted to mention small things, but like, I liked that kind of a lot of people had some things to do in this episode. Saru, I believe, was the one who suggested going outside the bounds and getting Tilly to outside of the chain of command to get the information. It was Adira who figured out what they need to do with the ships to stop the avalanche. So, you know, a good little quick moments to get a lot of people on screen, even if they weren't like playing the core roles in it.
Yeah, and even Stamets and Colbert were the ones able to get the twin moons out of the android's memory And
yeah, that's right.
And then, you know, that gives Michael the leverage to force Kovic to bring her in. So that was, you know, it's all big and dramatic and, you know, probably not how any like real life organization would work. But I think for, you know, TV logic, it all made sense.
Yeah, right.
And it was satisfying, you know, when Kovic was like, okay, I'm going to spill all of the beans. Here's my recap of a TNG episode called The Chase. And we're looking for this alien race that looks a lot like the Changelings, because the same lady who played the Changeling also played the progenitor.
I'd forgotten that.
But I loved the end of the episode, just like the enthusiasm. I know a lot of people like don't like her catchphrase of like, let's fly. I think if you have to have one, I think that's a fine one to have. It's kind of cringy that everyone has to get one, but I'm over it at this point. I've accepted that. But this episode... Both these episodes ended where I'm so excited to see what happens next.
Yeah, same here. It was actually only in retrospect, because initially I was really very enthused about the progenitors thing. I was like, that's a cool mystery to explore, resolve, tell us more about. Thinking about it a little bit more, though, you've heard me talk about how I didn't like in 2001 that it was like aliens that... you know, prompted early humans to sort of learn to use tools, which, you know, taught them violence, to move their, sort of keep them from becoming extinct, mm-hmm. basically. And because I think it's like, I always want that, you know, that's,
you don't want there to be a creator. You want just the life forms just came about on their own.
I want the cool, this is a cool thing that happened within the natural world. So we don't know exactly how yet, but, that just happened. And that's how, and the same with at least the creation of humans. Now, Star Trek has its own lore, and there's, for practical purposes, there's thousands and thousands of humanoid races. And it does make sense for that to be the case there. But yeah, I kind of want it to be, humans were created by natural processes, life sparked because that's what life does under very rare circumstances. So, but I'm not also not going to get too worried about it. I need it until I see what they want to do with it. You know, where are they going to go with this, with the progenitors? And I that it is exactly what I asked for, a Trek mystery to solve, to discover.
I would not want them to do like Ancient Alien stuff of like, and Gene Roddenberry hated that of like, someone came and taught us how to like build the pyramids and stuff like that.
Right. Respect what we did.
But I think the progenitor thing works with that, because it's like, oh yeah, all we did was just like, we just put DNA on a bunch of planets and then we died, and right. Everything y'all did after that, y'all did on, all we did was hit the start button, we hit play on the right. VCR and then died, and then whatever y'all did, you know, watching the movie was
yeah
his own
I think
thing.
That's fair. Father, let me quick ask, is that episode any good? I haven't watched it. I'm gonna watch it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's a fun one. I have a good time rewatching that one.
Okay.
I think a lot of people. I think it's a fan favorite. It's not like a. It's not on like a lot of like top 10 lists, but it's probably on like a lot of like top, I don't know, 50 lists.
Cool.
But yeah, I'll toss it on in the Tech Trek Discord sometime soon. Maybe if people wanna watch.
Obviously,
that.
The time is right.
Yeah, it's a good time to revisit it. I guess my final thoughts on Red Directive before we talk about Under the Twin Moons. I do love the pursuit of the progenitors as the kind of a big capper at like the end of the Star Trek timeline, at least like so far. I know they're doing this Academy yeah. show soon, and we're gonna get more 32nd century stuff, but I like the idea of like, that's kind of like the arc of the Star Trek universe, was all these different alien races across the galaxy. They all evolved in their own way and became like very unique. And then here far later in the 32nd century, after many of these races have started to come together and intermingle, and even now in the time of Discovery, we see all of these, you know, hybrid species people walking around, like the president of the Federation is part human, part Bajoran, part Cardassian. So it's right. like we've fulfilled our destinies and we've all like come back together. And the characters of the Star Trek universe literally are, you know, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And that's,
yeah,
I think that's kind of cool. Like, oh, that's what the progenitors were trying to do all along. And I think that's a worthy story to tell for your series, or for your final season. And
you think,
and
it could encapsulate real Trek values.
Yeah. But I guess I have some more on that, but I'll save that for when I get to my final thoughts on Under the Twin Moons. But go ahead, Dave.
Oh, I don't know if I have any particular like sort of other thoughts on it. I'm ready to learn the mysteries and to go exploring with them, to go fly with Burnham.
Oh, another thing. I know, like, you're at like a film festival. People are just, you know, they're going to be happy and they're going to applaud everything. And but there is a lot of positive energy at the theater at the premiere of this. You know, coming out of there,
That's cool.
People seemed really enthused. So that, and it does the scene that I wanted to tell people about that was like so cool in like the theater setting was the corridor fight when Michael expands the 32nd century Type 2 phaser and grows it into a Type 3 phaser rifle, like with a programmable matter. I love that use of the, like how they can casually do these extraordinary things.
It looks
but there's still
cool.
kind of an internal logic to all of it. You know, it still kind of makes sense. I do want a little, some of those things to be a little bit more defined, but yeah, it's so cool. And like the sound production was so good on like the theater speakers, and it's like it played so well. Just like every phaser blast was just like, it was so loud. And I appreciated like the cinematography and the editing a lot more just seeing it in that,
I bet.
Level of presentation.
I love a good loud and really crisp audio production on a movie and a theatrical experience. And by the way, Father E, 80s Dave, who loved so many action movies growing up, did appreciate just on that pure kid level Burnham getting a kick-ass weapon and like pinning those dudes down with them, Lock and Maul. It looked cool.
Nice. Well, let's change over from Red Directive to Under the Twin Moons. On this episode, Michelle Paradise described it as a lovely Burnham and Saru episode. So that's accurate, Michelle. I think you didn't give anything away and you summed it up, but. The official synopsis is, on Saru's last mission as Captain Burnham's number one, the team ventures to a seemingly abandoned planet to hunt for what might be the greatest treasure in the galaxy. So, Dave, I guess I'll take the opening statements first
on
this one. But how the hell could this not be the final season of Discovery? I mean, we're securing Stamets' legacy. We are saying goodbye to Saru. He's leaving Discovery. I know he's left before, but I mean, you really do kind of feel like a sense of appropriate finality to all of this. And the story of season 5, that's going to be kind of the reverse of season 1. Dare I say the mirror image of season 1, where instead of Lorca, you know, recruiting Michael and offering Michael the second chance, and it's all for his like, you know, own like selfish motivations, but this is the mirror of that. This is Michael being the one sincerely offering the second chance, and the guy that she's offering to it, this kind of a captain with Rainer, I think he embodies a lot of the traits that Prime Lorca probably has, that Mirror Universe Lorca tried to pretend to be. The guy who Lorca pretended to be the first few episodes of Discovery, that's kind of like who Rainer is. So it's almost like from that Lorca guy who is offering Michael a spot on the Discovery, it's like we've completely inverted that to now Michael is the captain offering this dude, this old white guy in his 50s.
And I should point out, she's doing it with better intentions. You know, Lorca was kind of had deceitful intent, and she really wants to.
Yeah, because he's from the Mirror Universe and she's from the Prime Universe. So that even like plays into like the, they are reflections. So,
but yeah, Rainer, she wants to help, and she believes he is like a genuine asset too.
Yeah, so I'm all for Rainer being the number one this season. My concern is in the episode when Saru says, Michael, I think you need a first officer like Book. And I'm like, I hope this doesn't happen, but now I'm terrified that Book and Michael are going to stay broke up the entire season, and then it's going to end with Rainer dying, and then Book becomes the first officer, and he's like in Starfleet, and he's in a uniform, and they're not in a relationship, they're just captain and first officer, and I would be sad if that happens, I think.
I was nervous when they brought up Book, because it seemed like one of those wild field promotions that you sometimes happens in Star Trek just to make, you know, keep the crew together, keep favorites together, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, that doesn't feel right. But then by the end of the episode, they threw out an alternative, and it probably will be a temporary thing. So you could be right to be worried, Father-y, but I guess I've got to see them deal with it before I can make much judgment on that. I wanted to mention that I was nervous throughout the episode because Saru is my favorite character on Discovery, and he's in the one day to retirement trope zone where you could get killed on, you know, your last day before you go into retirement. But I was pretty sure they wouldn't do that. They did tease it a little bit though. And I also wanted to mention that I almost, when we were doing our things we want to see, mentioned wanting to see Action Saru. I might have even used that term when I wrote it down and then deleted it, because I was like, oh, you know, this is the adventure season.
Oh, I've been saying that for years. Yeah. So.
And you know, I was like, oh, they could bust out him running around like when he went all feral on Burnham in that one episode. They could do some more stuff like that. And man, they totally did it. I should have put it in my hopes and dreams, because they caught me up on that. I didn't know
this
it was
so much cooler. This is so much cooler. Like when we see him like haul ass here, it looks so much cooler than like the CGI cheetah run that they gave him in Into the Forest. I go
I think I agree on that. He also got to do like take out drones with his little cheek pouch dart things. I think that, you know, I like a good jungle adventure. This was like a classic kind of jungle adventure with a lot of the characterization we expect from Discovery too. But the thing I wanted to mention, that sort of second chance that Rainer got, just real quick, is something that occurred to me is that I think he is emerging as somebody different from both Shaw and Jellicoe. He's defining himself. And what I like about him is that they're making this story where Burnham is going to have to work with him like at length, not just for an episode, but probably the whole season. And it had me thinking earlier. This is why I was asking you about the sort of generational thing, the storyline or allegory or whatever they did at the end of Picard season 3, where the Borg were like zapping the youngsters and only the old people over 25, the old people, you know, could withstand the Borg. And, you know, obviously that also works to give them a last hurrah, but it was a little bit of a weird sort of us versus them, you know, battle of different generations and like literally a battle. And I prefer what they're doing here on a conceptual level as a thematic to have the persistent, like a conversation between the two generations. He's like, I'm not a yes man. And she knows that. And but he also seems to have earned her respect. And so he's not going to be trying to, like, I think, overreach too much. But I like the conversation that suggested. It feels more grown up than Picard's sort of thematics were in that final episode. But I do think drones are boring threats.
And I don't really think of Rainer as Shaw or Jellicoe. So I think those are. I mean, to me, it's like, oh, he's clearly like prime Lorca. But I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one who
I feel like
that.
He's got a little Jellicoe to him. You know, the way Jellicoe took charge of that conference room. Reminded me of how he takes charge in this one when he's like, let's figure out what the power source is for these alien traps.
I love that. That's my favorite scene. But yeah, let's get into the
let's dive in.
The episode breakdown. You know, we start off getting a little recap of the last episode and explaining that the dots have to clean off all the radioactive sand. So I don't know if that's if we got Chekhov's wires, you know, fixing the android. We got radioactive sand. Now, is this going to be some Chekhov sand? Is it going to do something weird in a future episode?
Interesting. Yeah. I was not paying attention to that. Good point. Maybe.
Yeah, Saru says, you know, all these weird properties.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I did notice that now that you say it. You know, it's almost like the way they were able to read the writing on that thing with its radioactive iridescence.
Glowing bacteria. Yeah,
I wonder, but I can't tell what they would do with this. Well, we'll see.
I didn't know if we would see President Rilik in season 5 or not, but apparently we do. She is up front in episode 2, grilling Rainer, and it's a scene that kind of parallels the end of Battle of the Binary Stars when we saw Burnham on trial for her mutiny. So, you know, she knows what this feels like to be grilled by the brass like this and blamed for, you know, he didn't really do that bad of a thing. You know, like, you can understand his motivations, you know, so I thought it was cool, like, the stuff they do with Vance, talking about how they had been friends for decades and, you know, maybe they're not gonna be friends anymore. They're gonna force him into retirement. That's kind of surprising. You know, we see Starfleet captains make these insane, reckless calls all the time. You know, we like it. We cheer for Kirk and Sisko when they do this type of stuff, and then here Rainer actually faces like serious consequences. I guess if you're not like the main character of the show and you pull that shit, like, oh no, you'll get fired.
Well, I guess usually the I'm trying to think when other people pull this, they seem usually a little bit more concerned about the people, and he kind of seemed to just be ready to, at least, you know, what we saw him on the surface was like, The percentage is okay. Don't worry about it. You know, Picard or Kirk would be more concerned about the people. Yeah. So there is an attitude kind of issue here, I think, and that's what they were getting at. I appreciate, by the way, that Burnham initially didn't want to rat him out.
Yeah, that was cool. And I liked Vance being like, yeah, I see what you're trying to do here, but, you know, we got a direct order from the president, so...
You know, Father, I was thinking, I was trying to put myself a little bit in Rainer's shoes. He has, the burn was like, what, roughly 90,
like 120, 130 years?
Over 100 years, that's right.
Something like that.
And so they've been living in this scarcity galaxy with Emerald Chain issues and, you know, difficulty in travel, isolated, cut off for like their whole lives. He has not known a life with these sort of sudden dilithium offerings and resources that they have now. It makes sense that he would kind of be this guy who thinks more the way he thinks.
His 30 years in Starfleet were 30 of the shittiest years to be in Starfleet.
Right. But at the same time, it's like, if they are moving forward, if they are progressing Starfleet, then maybe it does make sense to retire him because, you know, he is a relic who doesn't, he didn't seem like he wanted to change much. Maybe if he had presented himself a little bit more with more contrition, they would have been more likely to do it.
But I think his problem was he got too much of that Captain Ahab chasing Moby Dick attitude. You know, he was putting his entire ship in danger. I wouldn't want to serve under him if he was captain.
It's true.
After that. But if he's first officer, if he has someone like Michael who can be like, no, disengage the tractor beam and drop out a warp, you're not going to kill your crew chasing these people. If he has someone to kind of police him, I think that's going to be better for him. And I also think Michael herself, I think she's better when there's someone more reckless than her in the room and she has to be, you know, a bit more of the grown up. I like that more than when she has to be the renegade.
Right. I feel like I would have a little bit of nervousness serving under her, knowing that she might magnetic grapple onto a ship and surf it.
But I feel like if Rainer's around, she's going to be the voice of reason.
Right. I think that's generally the case. She's, you know, she was the one who's like, let's check for relatives. Let's not destroy this. He's kind of been picking more destructive and risky paths. And so that offers a potentially interesting character arc for her in this final season. You know, she was very, it was either at the start of this episode or the first one where she was very, her captain's log was very existential and she's like doing that meaning of life stuff. And I wonder where they want to point that. I don't know, but she's clearly going to be, you know, looking for some sort of philosophical growth.
So, Grudge the Cat is back on Discovery. I know a lot of people were probably happy to see that.
I'm excited.
Grudge was not excited about her gift from Michael, which I think probably should have been expected. But I thought that was kind of a fun little... Oh, in the 32nd century, you just have like little holographic mice for cats to play with.
No more red dots.
But, you know, Grudge doesn't like holograms. She's like, no, I know that's not a real mouse. I can't smell it, so I'm not going to fall for your dumb game, you stupid human. Go away.
Do you think if Burnham and Book get back together, that Grudge might finally warm up to her a little bit as a member of the fam?
You know what I love in season 4 was when when Saru and Michael are doing those screams to vent their stress or whatever, and then you see Grudge just like run off from the chair like angry at them, like yelling like that, like
how dare you.
Yeah, it just seems like such like a realistic animal reaction. But I guess this scene is an indication of how Michael and Book are gonna behave around each other this season. I guess we're gonna get a lot of scenes of like this is like really awkward, I gotta go be around my ex again.
But they're also very mature about it, but I think that means that they could do that on the surface. They're both professionals. But there's going to be stuff behind the scenes that's going to be hard for them.
I think all their scenes are very watchable. They have good chemistry together. But I think that if they draw that out too much and focus on, you know, will they ever get back together or not? And they kind of play up the will they won't they. It might get kind of annoying after a while. But I agree with you. Like here, just within the first couple episodes, it all works so far.
Yeah, I actually cannot quite tell what they want to do with it. I think overall,
well, they want us stressed. They want us wondering, will they get together or not?
He is overall so much, it seems like, more an interesting fit for her than, say, early on than
Tyler. Yeah, it's like, you're not going to do better than Book. You're not going to find a better love interest for Michael than Book, so.
You know, but I also don't believe in the one as a concept. So, you know, part of me is like, you know what? If Book left tomorrow, she could find somebody if she wanted to, or she could live happily on her own if she wanted to as well. Within the cast and the characters and the situations they've got, I think it's a good fit. But yeah, they'd spent all of last season at odds. It makes sense that that doesn't just heal right away.
Yeah, and I thought, like, you know, they kind of seemed like they were on good terms at the end of season four, but then, like, when they never talked to each other. And I get that. It's like, Michael thought that he died. Michael saw him blow up. And it's just right. Like, oh, the fact that, like, he's just back in the universe, like, that's satisfying enough. I don't need to deal with, like, the, you know, all the emotional work of trying to unpack this. Be like, do I even still want to be in a relationship with this guy who went renegade last year? Do I even still, like, no, like, he's alive. He's off doing community service. He's good. I'm just not going to worry about it. I'm just going to worry about being a captain and going to my saxophone lesson. Like, right. it felt very natural and organic, which I'm always looking for.
Sometimes you have to lose yourself in a little bit of, it's not duty is the word I'm looking for, but just kind of regular stuff. Routine, I guess, is maybe what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Jill47 in the live audience says, Burnham is sick of having her boyfriend betray her. Healthy to take a break. And yeah, I kind of think that's what she's doing. If nothing else, it's just like, it would just be easier. It would just be easier not to deal with that right now, you know? But they're dealing with this treasure hunt mystery instead. So we get to our twin moon planet. I don't understand, is like the eclipse occurring, like when they get, they said it's like only once every 7 years, but they go to a temple and it's not during the eclipse of that temple, but there's an eclipse somewhere else on the planet, because we see an eclipse on the planet.
I guess the idea, I was a little lost in that too, was that there is an eclipse going on. But I believe the idea was that maybe when Velik was there, he picked the site of the eclipse or whatever to stash this information. Because, you know, it was like a sacred site. There's probably sacred sites all over the place on this planet. Mm. But that was the one, you know, that's the, you know... But yeah, like I guess there's like no set date that there's. I forget what there's that they're supposed to be targeting.
Yeah, they just said like it's once every 7 years. So I guess like they're like, oh look, here's like a temple, and once every 7 years the eclipse will be there. So.
Right. Maybe the eclipse doesn't cross over any other temples that were on there. To some degree, this is the nature of these kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark things, which is that like, or Da Vinci Code, they don't always make sense. You know, there's no real reason why people would exactly have a wild treasure hunt thing that you have to go through to find something. It was just better to hide it and burn all information.
If it's a Romulan who's obsessed with secrecy and security.
Right. I guess he's like, sense, I want smart Romulans to find it, not a bunch of dumbass Federation people.
And maybe we'll learn more about his motivations, I guess, later in the season. I kind of didn't think of him as like a, you know, a guy we were going to get to know anything more about. But I guess there still is some mystery as to what his bigger plans were, what he was going to do with this knowledge of the creation technology. Progenitor tech is what they keep calling it. So, yeah, I assume there's a progenitor device. It's like a Genesis device. But
yeah, God, yeah, man, that's how, like, I'm sort of thinking about it until I know otherwise.
It's like, it's going to be like a machine that, like, you press a button on it.
Right. And it shoots out humanoid life form DNA and little Genesis torpedoes to all the worlds.
Yeah, that's exactly what the visualization will look like. But speaking of visualizations, we get some really beautiful imagery, I think, on Lyric, on the Twin Moon planet. What do you think of the necropolis, of the Promillion necropolis?
It's my background right now for my StreamYards here. So I liked it. Yeah, no, I thought it was cool. I always think, I do sometimes notice, you know, I kind of wish they could throw some CG weird trees and shit in there, because it's always like earth trees and, but, you know, alien temples.
They do that sometimes. They'll turn like the trees red or something, but
yeah.
Instead we got the twin moons and the weird little floaty pollen stuff.
Yeah, no, it looked cool. I wanted to see, I think, a little bit more of the temple or the statuary and the temple guardian stuff. I might have liked to have seen a little bit more of that, a little less of the forest, but it was good. Like I said, this represents jungle adventure type scenario in the class, like, you know, like it would with, you know, in The Mummy or Raiders of the Lost Ark or anything like that, even Pirates of the Caribbean.
They went to Brazil to shoot this, so they were like down in the rainforest.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
But and it was fun. If this is going to be Saru's last mission on the Discovery, you know, it's fun to get to have so much dialogue and banter with Michael. These people have been friends
for... made peace with the possibility that this is his last appearance. I just assumed that,
I don't think it's his last appearance, but I think it's the last time, like, he's not going to be the first officer on the ship anymore the rest of the season.
Right. I'm hoping for essentially the Tilly type scenario. We're going to see his ambassadorial stuff. It's going to probably have some input on the story, you know, the main story later on. And they will cross paths again. And, that'll be the episode where the weird radiation dust does its thing.
You were pointing out the dialogue earlier. We were joking around, but the one last dance and I shall follow your lead.
Yeah.
What a great line.
Yeah. Doug Jones is really good with that kind of stuff. I think he can say stuff that would sound a little kind of corny otherwise, but he says it so sincerely.
And so like embodies their relationship in that, like he could be captain of the, you know, he could be the star of the show, but like, he's okay stepping aside to let her shine, let her take the spotlight.
There's a part I wrote it down because it was memorable when she's talking, I guess this was this on the ship or was this in the jungle? She says, you've always seen something in me, even when others didn't, even when I didn't.
Yeah, and that's true. Like, even when he hated her way back in season one, when he is so pissed at her for getting Captain Georgiou killed, and he tells Lorca, I don't like this woman, but I don't know a more brilliant officer in all of Starfleet. And then Lorca being like, damn, and he knows you, Stamets, you know, kind of like rubbing that into Stamets' face. But so like even when Saru hated Michael, he still respected the hell out of her.
He's the real deal. Like she said, how the hell am I going to find another you?
Yeah, but then it makes me nervous when he says, like, oh, you should find someone like Book. It's like, no. She needs to find someone like Rainer. And Book needs to be her boyfriend again. That's what needs to happen, Saru. That's what you should be telling her.
I agree. Rare case of, you know, he's got his... he's got love on the mind. And so maybe that's why he's, like, trying to play Cupid there. Trying to bring fulfillment to her.
There are some other good lines I like when they beam down and you know, it is eerie. It's this beautiful world, but it's an acropolis for not just anyone, but like an extinct species. So not only are you surrounded by corpses, but like the people who buried these corpses are also corpses now. Like it is like the deadest place you can go to, and there being kind of a peacefulness to them, but it would also be kind of scary and unsettling, I think. Like I kind of find silence both like comforting and terrifying both. It can be a...
Well, it's a very cemetery or tomb vibe is what they're talking about. You know, they both... Yeah. Yes, you're literally around corpses, but for a lot of people, that's a very kind of peaceful and tranquil place, very sort of spiritual. Or
for a lot of people, that's the only time you'll know peace is after death.
That's an interesting point.
And Saru and Michael, I feel, are both people who have not known much peace in their life. You know, Saru as someone who, until Vihara, I just felt constantly terrified of everything.
Incidentally, people should watch the Ready Room tied to this episode, because Doug Jones talks meaningfully about the role and even like stuff he pulled from Saru, including that ability to, you know, that he sounds like he deals with anxiety and fear and has a tough time with it. And that Saru, maybe this is just, you know, PR stuff. I don't know. I kind of don't think it's completely PR. But he talked about how Saru going through Vihara and you know, changing his approach to things was something that emboldened him too.
That's interesting to me too. And I remember from the very beginning, a lot of people talk about, you know, finding Saru's constant state of fear very relatable to people with anxiety. And I don't, my relationship with anxiety is quite different now than it was when we started talking about Discovery in 2017. But it is interesting to me that like they made the choice to like physically like remove that to where like he no longer has that characteristic post season two.
Right. He's still thoughtful. He's still not a guy who like just wildly leaps into action. But he has confidence.
But he still retains a lot of that, more so than anything. I think I understand the empathy of Saru more now, that like as someone who was constantly having to, you know, worry about like the vibes people are giving off and trying to, you know, he was always trying to like read the room for his own safety. But now he's able to do that as kind of this very benevolent, helpful, kind. He has such a capacity of kindness now. You know, I love like the scenes of him being, we've talked about him as like the more paternal figure
right.
when he's when he's like nurturing like younger people, like how he kind of like towers over everyone, like he has like the dad because he is so tall, you know.
Yeah, in that sense, he's one of my favorite first officers.
But there's a gentleness to him. You know, he's this massive towering thing, but he also seems so gentle. You know, he doesn't seem as like a physical. He's super strong, but he still doesn't seem threatening unless, you know, he's pointing his attack gangula at you.
He only does that for taking out drones.
Well, let's talk a little bit about like Tilly and Adira and the security drone attack that happens. I thought it was cool that we got like a little banter between the two of them, though, and they get to catch up a little bit, and we find out what's going on in Adira's world. It sounds like they're happy to have space that Gray is gone and not a ghost in their head anymore, and they're kind of like uncomfortable with how happy they are, you know. That's interesting.
I don't know if this was meant to be a thematic, but you know, the twin moons of the planet had me thinking about couples, you know.
Yeah.
Locke and Maul, Book and Burnham, Tarina and Saru, and here we've got Adira and Gray. And Adira, I thought this was a nice bit of insight, the idea that they are enjoying feeling a little bit, coming into their own. And then like a part of them is like, oh no, what am I, you know, but I'm enjoying myself without Gray, who's been so close to me for so long. You know, is that wrong? You know, am I doing something wrong? So I really liked that. Am I right? Was it in season 4 where Tilly, like initially kind of is frustrated with them kind of at some point, and like Stamets has to say, they're, you know, really look up to you and are trying to impress you, but it's coming across kind of obnoxiously or something like that. It was what was throwing Tilly off. Like, they've had a connection, too, Adira and Tilly.
Yeah, then Adira was in All Is Possible when Tilly was stranded on the snow moon with the cadets.
Right.
Well, there's only 46 moons instead of 47. They did that just to piss me off, I think. But but I like that Adira and Tilly are part of the solution here. And I think they do a good job kind of showing, like, the teamwork, the team effort. When they find the skeletal remains of the grave robbers and then the attack drones come out.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, I don't know if I would say, like, I didn't mind these drones. But I guess they're not, they are a little, I don't know.
I guess we've seen drone stuff in, you know, other kind of adventure fiction, sci-fi and things like that. I would have preferred, honestly, something like the statuary, you know, having like mechanized stuff under it, you know, built by some ancient race, and that you know, they like get up like these big statue mechs. I think I would have preferred that personally.
I think they did a good job just selling the danger of these things, how they're,
sure.
How it just keeps sending out more and more, and they're always pinned down. One of the things I really appreciated was, like, I constantly felt like the danger, the stakes, you know, like they're constantly having to rapid fire, like, figure shit out and make choices, and it's just like, go, 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 go. Everything, there's like an urgency to everything.
Right. You know, when I was talking in the pre-show thing, in our things we do and don't want to see, I mentioned that I didn't want to see that sort of weightless, you know, amusement park sort of action adventure, which I thought, mm-hmm. I was worried about because of Michael riding the ship. And this is a good example of, like, there need to feel like there's going to be consequences. Even if we know, I bet Burnham doesn't die in this episode. I need to still, you can, yeah, make me, you can trick
but
me.
If,
My
in
brain
the
will
heat
be
of the
tricked.
Moment,
yeah.
If you shoot and edit an action scene well, then like a seasoned TV viewer who knows in their heart, yeah, there's no way Michael Burnham's going to die in this episode. But if you present it well, you can make that person gasp like, oh no, I was so scared. I thought that was about to take her head off, or, you know, whatever. Like, yeah, there's a way to pull that off. What I really liked, though, was when it did get stressful like that, and then Rainer shows up to kind of save the, but he doesn't like swoop in and save the day. He's just being a team player along with everyone else, but he's, yep, contributing. But I love the Rainer Zoom call. That is my favorite part.
It's great.
Of the episode.
He has a forceful personality, and it is a little bit more like, it's sometimes it's like an old timer who does kind of know their shit and is kind of like really can help, but you know, it's maybe a little bit less with the kid gloves that the Discovery crew is used to.
Yeah, I love, like, as soon as, like, he shows up and they're like, why do you even know what we're talking about? And he's like, I've been monitoring all the, you know, the crucial comms or whatever. He's like, they told this guy, they forced him into early retirement. And he hasn't even, like, taken off his uniform. He's still, like, monitoring comms. He, like, Zoom calls in. And I liked his attitude where he's just like, fuck you. You think they had cloaked antimatter 2,000 years ago? You gotta stop thinking like a modern day scientist. You gotta think how they thought back then. It's just like, where they're like, how did you even know to, like, call us? He's like, 30 years in Starfleet, that's how. And he's like, Zora, or whatever the fuck you are, like, you're gonna help out with this too. He starts talking to the computers. It's like, I don't know, I love, like, his take charge attitude there.
Well, Father, we've talked about sometimes Discovery needs somebody to be a little bit mean on it. And in this case, he's being mean with a good purpose. But, you know, yeah, if we don't have Michelle Yeoh, or if we don't have Tarka off being an asshole for love, then, you know, This guy is providing some of that. Yeah, and I was, by the end of this episode, I was sold on him as a presence for the show. And I really like what I think the situation that's going to bring about. It makes me look forward to the episodes. I want to see him arguing with Burnham and them trying to figure this out with his experience versus her. She has a certain perspective that he doesn't. I mean, lots of things different than him. And I'm looking forward to seeing them interact.
The action Saru moment that they build it up. I think they want us to think like, oh, are they going to kill Saru? Is he about to die? But I don't know. I'll say, like, I never did fall for this one.
I didn't seriously either.
But it was still fun watching it play out.
Yeah. And they did do some dope special effects with him doing the super high speed stuff. He got to use the attack ganglia and all that stuff.
Yeah, one last. This might be the last time we ever see that. Although I hope if Saru doesn't use the attack ganglia in Discovery anymore, maybe he shows up in a future Star Trek project at some point and he busts that out again.
He should.
But and it's, he, you it's know, he got the last he, we see of it.
He got the hero wound, Father. He a classic shoulder wound. That's a classic.
One of the most convenient places to be shot in film and television, I guess.
I think, did when Maul got shot in the first episode or injured a little bit, wasn't that same kind of thing?
It was probably like right shoulder, like the exact same spot. You know what I thought was funny is that with the programmable matter bracelet, like Michael Burnham made a phaser to drop in the statue to overload and blow it up. Mm-hmm. And then like she just made another phaser to shoot at the drones. It's like, I wonder how many of those things you can make. You know, I'm going to assume you can make 47, like one bracelet. Like, can put out 47.
That sounds about right. It's probably a pretty clear-cut answer. I think you're probably
it is not like a solid number, you know. It's like you can't make infinity of them, you know. It's, you got to stop at some point, but
right, energy I'm sure energy supply is probably their big limit in the future.
But I liked the big action climax.
Mm-hmm. And I like this sort of the puzzly stuff. It you know, it's the point where I realize, I mean, they are going to embrace the tropes of the genre. This is Da Vinci Code stuff and Raiders of the Lost Ark 2. Was it somebody over in our Discord server was mentioning there is a bit of the Staff of Ra from Indiana Jones type of thing where they got the full five verses and Malin Locke only got four. And so they're digging in the wrong place.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Which it kind of seemed like that's such like a same thing as Raiders of the Lost Ark.
But potentially a little samey.
I feel like if I didn't know that they were, if I didn't know to be looking for that stuff, I think this would have been like an aha moment to me. If, say, I was just the person who doesn't keep up with the Star Trek news, like the typical Star Trek Discovery viewer never reads about it on the internet. They just like click play sometimes when they see there's new episodes on Paramount Plus and they never listen to these podcasts and they don't go to conventions. That's like most of the people who watch the show are like that. And for them, they haven't heard all this talk of like season 5 is going to be this epic quest. It's going to be a lot of fun action adventure-y type things. You know, they haven't been getting all of that.
They just
they just tuned in now. So when they see that, this is like an aha moment for them to be like, oh, they're going to do a Raiders of the Lost Ark type Indiana Jones kind of story this season, I guess.
I don't even know if they think that, Father. That first Indiana Jones was over 40 years old.
That's true. But a lot of older people watch Star Trek, so it's
that's true.
I think we're good.
Straight up discussed previously.
The kids who watch Star Trek are probably kids who watch Indiana, like their parents.
You know, their parents made them watch it. Yeah.
I don't know if either one of my parents ever watched Raiders of the Lost Ark, but they weren't movie people. But I didn't want the reason Michael and Saru are able to solve the puzzle is because Saru just happens to have like alien eyes that can see the bacteria. On rewatch, I paid a little bit more attention to that, and I was like, oh, but he did have to have, like, the scientific knowledge of, like, okay, but now we have to, like, look for it with the tricorders. It's like, I just saw a little bit of what I know is like glowing bacteria because of all of our science learning that we have. So right. I like that like, they're still using their big brains.
We've got to do some tech shit. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want them to defeat Maul and Locke because Saru has Kelpian eyes. I want them to do it because, you know, of who they are.
Right. I agree with that.
But it was so cool to have, like, the stressful, you know, like, oh, no, the statue is coming back online. Michael, Saru, y'all need to hurry up. You know, this is Tilly telling you, like, oh, okay, hurry up, like, beam the hell up now, it's gonna shoot you. And I just barely get up in time. That was so, like, I'm not saying this to, like, make fun of any other Star Trek show, because I love every Star Trek show. I like all of them. But a lot of Star Trek shows, like, they would have done, like, their big action climax, and then they just would have had, like, okay, let's have, like, a boring talk about what's on the back of the statue, and they wouldn't have... I don't know. It wouldn't have been as fun to watch.
Yeah, they seem acutely aware of ramping up the tension in this and doing some fun last minute stuff in it. You know, last minute block the avalanche, last minute get us the F out of here before the drones reactivate, all that.
And I'm also curious, will we, I wonder, will episode 3, will we see this entire adventure on Trill and then maybe cut back to this planet and see Maul and Locke have returned to figure out, like, why was there, you know, not a clue on Beta Zed? You know, what did we miss here? I'm wondering if they'll come back.
I wanted to see Beta Zed more than
I know.
Trill.
It's like, I've already seen 32nd Century Trill. Can I please see 32nd Century Beta? But I don't know. Maybe they'll show us both. I don't know.
Yeah, they should.
But because they do make such a point of reminding us that Michael and Saru chose not to destroy another culture's sacred site, I do wonder, like, will they pay consequences for that? Will Maul and Locke find a clue when they come back here?
Right. Yeah, I don't know if we've quite seen, but, like, I assume that they are not going to be so careful and that they might blow it up, but... They haven't just been blown up. Well, you know what? They blew up a mountainside.
I don't think they're too worried about.
They're a little collateral damagey. Yeah. Okay. Okay. But yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing that. Seeing just how they dealt with it.
Well, let's talk about like the book Beast story and the stuff he does with like the dark comms and all the stuff with Culber and Stamets. But I guess book is brought in to help figure out Maul and Locke with Culber.
Yeah, like there's that Culber makes the distinction, the semantic distinction. Because he's like, I didn't ask you what you were doing. I asked how you were doing because Book is trying to kind of deflect a little bit. He doesn't want to talk about it, which I get. And even so, he stays focused on the job. They're doing sort of forensic work ultimately. And he figures out they're couriers, that they're like couriers who are all about the action, all about the juice.
Not just any couriers, but they're Suis.
Oh, right, right. That's been mentioned before? Probably not.
No, that's a new bit of lore.
Yeah, apparently they have their crazy people, I'm sure, who is like, oh yeah, he can get it there, you know, if he doesn't get killed along the way, you know, that kind of thing.
But they also have this, like, courier slang talk that I don't think we've ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it sounds more colorful coming from David Ajala with his Cockney accent than it does coming from Maul and Locke, I think. But
yeah.
I think it also runs the risk. It might get annoying if they too much of the, like, Strivers, this is code for them outfleet and starfleet. I got a boom for you, itching to sell it. Hit back, yeah? Like, it might be a bit much.
I like them calling their cash or letting them shine and stuff like that.
I did like when Book talked about Vance, like, well, at least he didn't throw me back in the clink or clinker, whichever he said. But, like,
yeah.
I like that term made it to the 32nd century somehow.
Yeah, was it ever called that? Was it because of, like, the closing gates made a clinking sound or whatever?
That's always been my assumption, but I don't know. There might be another... A lot of times there's stuff like that, and people make, like, the obvious assumption, and then it turns out to not be true. So maybe someone should unpack that.
I was looking at my notes, Father, and I'd forgotten that, like, Culber actually gives Book a hug when they see him. That's good. You want a hug from Culber.
Benjinium in our live audience is saying, I am really liking Ajala's performance and character direction this season. And Benjinium, I agree. I like David Ajala's acting on this show more and more every year. He needs to be the lead of his own show. And I was talking to Dave recently. I think I might have been on the show last week when we were talking about Starfleet Academy. And I was saying, you know, I think Mary Wiseman can carry that show as the lead, but I want her to have a co-lead who to kind of balance her out, someone who's very different from Tilly. I don't know if they would want to use two established characters instead of creating a character of their own, but I don't even know if there's like a role for Book at Starfleet Academy, you know, just like at the school, not even like in the show about the school, but like, what would he even do there? But I think like, if you did a show starring Tilly and Book, those characters are so different. Like, you would be able to cover so much ground with the two of them as your leads. I don't know. Like, maybe they bring on like, there's a lot of gritty, ugly corners of the galaxy, and Starfleet cadets need to be exposed to that too. And then Book is going to be here to be a consultant for those lessons. But I think he would be a great asset for the Academy show. And he will be a lead on a TV show. He's a good enough actor. So, or he's going to start doing movies. Like, Star Trek should, like, you know, get him signed up on something, or we're going to lose him.
And, you know, he's an environmental guy. He kind of likes holistic big picture views of it, because that's kind of the planet he grew up on. Mm-hmm. I actually do think there's a lot that he could teach in there.
And I think he's become my favorite character. Well, my favorite Discovery character is Anson Mounts Pike in season 2, but I think my second favorite is Book.
I mean, that's a good call. I like Book a lot. And, you know, after the last season, he was, you know, basically kind of broken after episode 1 and had to, like, I think David Ajala did a great job with it, but, you know, he was portraying morose a lot, with moments of levity when he would run into Burnham, or when he could have a kind of a normal conversation with Tarka. But it's nice to see him out from under that shadow. He's not like, you know, he's not full on, you know, flying by the seat of his pants adventurer Book that we met in season 3, but he's somewhere between that and his morose period. And it's nice to see him, like I said, it's just nice to see him get away from being that broken as he was.
Well, let's get to our ending. Mm-hmm. So we figure out that we now have 1 of 5 map pieces. So this is very video gamey. This is very like side questy, but you know, I'm okay with that. It would frustrate me if it was, I think, the plot of a 2-hour movie was we're going to have to go through a checklist and do each of these 5 things. But I think that's really good for a TV show telling a serialized arc. I want to have, okay, we're going to go to 5 different Planet of the Weeks and have 5 different Star Trek episodes about 5 different things that then tie together.
You know, I talked about, when I was talking about the structure of some of these treasure hunt things, the old G.I. Joe cartoon, and for at least several of their miniseries, they had a tried and true format. There would be something that would be like either some fuel resource that they had to find. It's like, oh, you have to go to the bottom of the sea for this one. Oh, this one can only be found in these Arctic mines. This one can only be found in the desert or whatever. And they would give them cool, fun places to go. And, you know, it was a formula, but it works pretty well. I think I am more interested in this than, say, in like the... where they're almost acknowledging in some ways the tropes of adventure stuff than I was in Red Angel's season, say.
And the big reveal of Maul, that Book decides, oh, she must be that girl Malene, the daughter of Cleveland Booker IV.
Remind me what the deal is with his name, how he...
So the way that couriers work is it's all about trust, and you have to have a reliable courier. You know, you need someone you can trust to deliver whatever from point A to point B. So the couriers make their living off of their reputation. Mm-hmm. And if you have like a really good reputation, when you retire, you can like sell that to, you know, someone younger than you. And our Book is actually, he's the 5th Cleveland Booker, and he mentioned a 4th. Right. In season 4, when he's talking to Reno about Tarka, and he's trying to explain to Reno that Tarka's not that bad. He's just trying to get back to someone. But more importantly, he's trying to keep a promise. He promised that he would meet him in that other universe. And he's talking about how, you know, when Book comes from, you know, that courier background, like that, like being a man of your word and being true to your promises, that's so important. And he's like, I understand, you know, where Tarka is coming from. And my mentor, Cleveland Booker IV, would understand. I'm hoping that we meet Cleveland Booker IV, because it sounds like he's still alive. He's just retired somewhere. That'd so I'm hoping cool. that we, like, Book goes to him and we meet, like, the guy who taught Book how to be a courier.
Father, what did you think about the overall reveal? It is one of those, like, a little bit weirdly small world stuff that made me cringe just a little bit. But it does fit in with the fact that we're already seeing that these aren't traditional villains. They are antagonists. They can be dangerous, but they're not traditional villains. And in fact, Book is going to be put in a position where he would like to potentially save this person, get close to this person.
Book likes them. Book is like, you know, when he points out, like, look at them, you know, having fun together, when he says,
that's right. He kind of works up the profile based on kind of his not, you know, a formal training, but street smarts. And
yeah. You know, he remembers when he was having, you know, courier adventures with Michael, that year when it was just the two of them. You know, he's probably thinking how much more fun it looks to be Maul and Locke, mm-hmm. you know, compared to being Book and Burnham. That I think that is an interesting conflict. And I wonder, I don't know if they would like turn Book against the crew two seasons in a row.
No, but
I think there's going to be a temptation. I think there's going to be like you know, like Jesus in the desert type of moment.
Well, you know that, like, Raynor, if he finds out that Book has some sympathies for them, is going to be like, yeah, you need to be confined to quarters while the grown-ups deal with this threat.
Well, yeah, Raynor is not going to tolerate any sympathy for Maul and Locke.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that when Book was talking about how he, you know, kind of respected and liked them, I'm kind of surprised Raynor didn't, like, hologram into the room right then and there and be like, what the hell do you mean that you like and respect them? Do you have any idea how dangerous these two are? How many years I've been chasing them?
I've been monitoring communications once again.
They're like, shit, aren't you supposed to be retired? Like, you still got your uniform on, bro. I don't know. You have any other thoughts on the Book and courier stuff?
You know, I liked that. I liked sometimes when they move our knowledge forward kind of quickly. And them being couriers made sense. Book gets not a ton of information, but, you know, figures out a few key things about them. I guess it was Raynor who says, when he said they don't care about anybody but themselves, that's a very Raynor sentiment. He feels like he knows them. He's figured them out. We've gotten a good sort of start to get a profile on them at this point. Hopefully episode 3 will give us a little bit more nuance, you know, there and teach us some more about them.
Yeah, I'm kind of more curious about Locke than Maul because his weird alienness. And they said, like, we don't know what species he is, which that's kind of unusual. You would think that Starfleet, by this point, would know pretty much every alien, at least in our galaxy. So there's something unique about him. And it doesn't feel too small world to me, I think, for this other courier to have, like, a connection to,
right.
you know, the courier on our ship with Book. But I think it would feel too small world to me if Locke has some connection to the progenitors or so. I think whatever his weird alien background origin is, I think it should be something that's kind of separate from that and kind of unique. But it could be, maybe he just doesn't know. Maybe he's like an orphan. He doesn't know what he is or who he is. So maybe that's part of his.
Or is he like a changeling and they still, you know, he carries the biological. No, because the changelings probably weren't created by the progenitors. They're not typical humanoids.
Yeah, but they might have been. I mean,
they might have been. I was just trying to think, is his motivation like, my people, our ability to shape change is part of that virus from way back when Section 31 virus bombed them. And I need to find out this secret because, you know, then I can save my people or something, you know, for something noble like that. But I kind of get the impression, do Locke and Maul, do they know what they're looking for?
They do now because Book told them.
Did he mention the progenitor thing?
Well, they cut away from that conversation, which might have been intentional. They might have not wanted us to hear everything that Book says to Maul and Locke.
Until it's important to know.
Or they might have just wanted to spare us, like, Book giving, like, the recap on this treasure is. You know, it could be that, like, they have, like, they're all in on the plan, and they just did this to, like, so that the Federation would spring Book from captivity, and he's
maybe.
Gonna... But I don't think that either. I'm just spitballing theories, but...
When they went to Fred, they didn't like the amount he told them, but I didn't get the impression that they had any real problem with, you know, selling to a kind of a shifty bad person, whatever. I don't think they necessarily knew what it was, but maybe.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah. They didn't know until Book told them. Because Maul even says, now that we know what this is, now that we know how hot of an item this is, we're actually going to be even more invested in, you know, finding it and finding someone to sell it to, you know, so... I guess they were just looking to, like, get rid of the trinket, of, like, the diary that was in the mystery box. You know, they're just looking to, like, offload that. They just didn't know exactly what it was. Because all they had was the diary. They don't have any of that recording that that Tilly got.
Right, that's true.
So all of their information they just got from the diary. And the Discovery crew has access to all of that information because Fred, the android, flipped through all of it.
And Locke and Maul don't know that what he saw yet, though. Aaron in the audience says, maybe this is a strange question, but why doesn't Starfleet just try to buy it from them?
It's actually a good point. Like, you would think they would be able to put together the capital to do that. Like,
Fathery, they don't use money anymore. that's the big oops about all of this.
Just give them a ship or something. Just be like, yeah, oh, right. You have a little ship. Here, you can have the Antares. Wouldn't that piss Rayner off?
But yeah, they could probably afford more than 3 bars of Latinum or whatever.
Yeah. But I like that they're not anything, you know, too exotic. They're just 2 couriers that are like, right, really, but they're smart and they're good at their job. And they're just like looking to make a buck. They're just looking to live their best life together. And they just happen to, you know, cross paths with this super valuable thing that Discovery Crew is going to be after. So that's fun. That's a fun antagonism. I really like that.
I feel like for future cosplayers that are couples, this is a good cosplay, hashtag cosplay goals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of people are going to be like, well, I don't know about a lot of people, but I don't know. Some people are going to be like, oh, yeah, are you my ride and die like Maul and Locke? I think that's going to be a thing.
Unless they turn out to be really do something monstrous in some later episode. You know, the Daenerys effect. Oops.
I don't know. I like them. I think they're good bad guys. I think so, too. Dave likes them. I see, like, they're a bit divisive, though. I see some people like them, some people don't like them. But I definitely am curious about learning more, hopefully, in episode 3.
I'm a sucker for a couple on the run, you know. I have seen Bonnie and Clyde and Natural Born Killers and various stripes of things in between. And it's interesting to see what as an audience will forgive if we think that a couple is appealing or good for each other. It's just saw a movie called Love Lies Bleeding with Kristen Stewart. Same basic premise there. How much true romance? Jill brought it up in the audience. Good example there. That was definitely Tarantino pushing the limits of like, oh, what do you expect from a traditional hero? Are you okay if they kill somebody? And so on.
I've never seen True Romance.
Good stuff. I recommend it.
You know, it's been on my list for like 25 years. I just haven't gotten around to it. Maybe someday.
And I see that Rachel says that there's a Bonnie and Clyde musical. Notes that people love romantic bad guys. It's true. It's maybe we all like to imagine ourselves with somewhat more interesting lives and romances than actually happens sometimes.
But I think that's just a very fascinating concept in general for people to think about, is that like, oh yeah, even like the really bad people, the people that I think of as bad guys, like, but they still have people that they love. They still have,
sure,
still have people that they care about. So a lot, well, not all of them, but some of them do.
Yeah. Unless they're straight like sociopaths or hardcore narcissists or megalomaniacs or whatever. Most of them probably do. Yeah.
We have Saru's goodbye to Michael, where it's like, okay, in case there is a season 6 and I am going to be back on the ship, I'm going to leave all of my plants here. so, you know, we can use the set next season.
Thanks for leaving us work, Saru.
I also wonder, like, what if Rayner has to, like, these are, like, the first officer's quarters, so now, like, Rayner has to, like, live in the swamp.
Oh, my God.
It's all, like, humid and nasty.
You're going to see him with the most sour face ever, just with a spray bottle of water.
Yeah. Don't touch the swamp kelp when it's in bloom, Rayner.
But I loved this scene, though. You know, again, they're great together. They really ended up projecting what you wanted from that sort of familial brother and sister type of relationship, and sometimes mentor and mentee, even though it would sometimes change a little bit as to who was the mentor. But yeah, I liked that their sort of embrace had him sort of gently placing his forehead against hers. It's very, very sweet, not quite typical gesture.
Yeah, it gave the little forehead touch that I wanted them to have in, spoilers for Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2, but in the Water of Life sequence, the Reverend Mother and Jessica didn't touch foreheads like they do in the book, and that kind of bothered me. But Doug Jones and Sonequa Martin-Green tried to make it up for me here in Discovery. so thank you for that. I got the forehead touch I needed this year.
In the comments, Father, they're wondering what would happen if Rayner was a surprisingly a damn good gardener.
I would love that. I would love that plot twist. That's Star Trek as hell, to be like, but yeah, in my downtime when I'm not chasing these criminals, I do love to garden.
Yeah, that's what he can get a little peace in his world.
Yeah.
something he can control.
Speaking of like those fun kind of civilian life type moments in Star Trek that we, you know, we don't get to see a ton of, but what you were talking about earlier of Admiral Vance cleaning up. He was working on some geometry stuff for his kids' homework. But I like that we didn't have a name for his daughter before, but now we know her name is Charlie. So I assume that she's named Charlie after her dad, Admiral Charles Vance. That's so cool because Michael is named after her dad, Mike Burnham.
Oh,
played
right.
by Sonequa Martin-Green's husband, who she kept calling daddy on set when they were shooting that stuff, just to weird people out. But she likes to tell that story at conventions.
Oh, man. You know, we're looking at a still frame of Vance's quarters, and I have to say, that is a pretty monochromatic, painful, you know, gunmetal blue sort of color. It's not real warm and inviting. Thank God the kids made a bit of a mess, and there's like a little chair and stuff for them and some brighter colors, because otherwise I'm not liking this particular future look.
Well, that's because they built all those uniforms and stuff in sets for like season 3. But right. Discovery's presence has slowly brought more color and vibrance and more of that 23rd century energy that I like back to the Federation. So I think that by the time we get to Starfleet Academy, it's all going to be more bright and colorful.
Yeah. No, I'm sure of it. They wanted a little bit of, I think, that clean and, you know,
that very sterile look, which a kind of Star Trek, like the Starfleet aesthetic is kind of on that trajectory anyways. Like if you go from like the original series to like TNG to like Picard, like, you know, like Picard season 3, all the ships are like, you know, they're real sleek looking, like everything's like very like metallic and shiny. So it is kind of like a, you know, kind of looks like it would go in that direction. And then Disco wormholes into the future and kind of like resets things to the 23rd century more colorfulness, I think.
Right.
Not necessarily like, oh no, we got to start putting like more color and stuff, but it's just a fun thematic, you know.
Yeah, theme. They bring a little bit of a 23rd century messiness with them.
Yeah, Jill points out the color palette on Disco was always too blue, but what I mean. It's from the time period of like the more colorfulness.
So. Right.
Yeah, so they get to the future, and then they start putting on the more colorful shirts.
But yeah, Father, just as a general thing, I like seeing Vance, you know, with his kids. There's no way you could ever convince me that he's a secret bad guy at this point, or, you know, a sleeper agent or anything like that.
I hope he continues to be the head of Starfleet in Starfleet Academy, and that we have more use of his character than in there.
Yeah, agreed.
And same with Kovich. I want Kovich to be around. I think he will be, because what's the name of the Cronenberg? David Cronenberg?
Yeah.
He says a while ago that like they keep using him more and more in Discovery because he lives close by in Toronto, and when he's not making his own movies, he's not really like doing anything else, and he's a pretty cheap actor to hire. It's, you know, convenient work for him. It's not a big deal for him to like drive across town and go play Kovich for an afternoon and then drive back home. So it's like, I guess they're gonna keep using more and more of him. So, but I think that's exciting for the Academy if they have that arsenal in their tool if they have that. I'm mixing my metaphors, huh? If they have that tool in their toolbox, I think that's.
I think he would be a good fit too. Although if they keep him mysterious, I'm picturing these poor kids where Kovich comes in and he's like, "You have a lot of promise, young man, but you need to learn to apply yourself." And they're like, "Who was that? Who is he? Is he a teacher? Is he the principal?" They're like, "Nobody knows."
Yeah, no. Even Vance doesn't know. No, nobody knows who this guy really is. That scene of Rayner and Burnham hanging out when Burnham does, you know, make him the offer to join her crew. I liked Vance having like that appreciation of the old Discovery rolling into dry dock and just, you know, being like, yeah, they don't make them like that anymore. They really don't. You know, we do know now that Discovery will permanently be a one of a kind.
You said Vance. You mean Rayner?
Right? Rayner. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Rayner.
Right. It softens him a little bit to see him be able to appreciate something like that. Or when he talked, you know, it's like he almost couldn't quite find the words for it. To when he talked about the possibility that he could have lost that encampment or that like market town, which clearly did distress him. It's just that he's a kind of guy who, well, he said that he'd already dug his hole or whatever.
Right.
But also, he's not a guy who apologizes. And he's also probably not a guy who's real comfortable with saying, you know, talking about his feelings and stuff.
Yeah, and I think he didn't want to like beg. He didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to come off as like, you know, I'm playing this up, you know, please feel sorry for me. He was like, no, like I'm man enough to admit, like, you know, y'all, I made the choice I made. Y'all don't like it. Like, it is what it is.
He's very much an "it is what it is" kind of guy.
But I liked his excitement when Burnham did. You know, he seems so defeated. It's like I mean, all this guy cared about was being a Starfleet captain. You know, like I was saying, like during like the worst years, it was to be a Starfleet captain. You know, this guy like busted his ass for years, I'm sure, trying to make the galaxy a better place. And now like he doesn't have that. And then when Michael is like gives him a new mission, it's the same type of excitement that I got at the end of the first episode when Kovic agrees to bring Burnham in on the mission and she says, let's fly. It's then here when we got Rayner on board, it's like, okay, I'm ready for episode three. I'm ready for the next puzzle, the next piece of the quest.
Jill in the comment says, I love how he zips up his jacket to accept. Yeah. And she smiles and walks away wordlessly. And yeah, absolutely. That was, I love good visual storytelling. That's
and a little auditory, like the jacket zip, you know, it's there's something kind of energizing about that. When you hear that, you're like, oh, I'm zipped up. I'm ready to go. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, it's go time, man.
A zipper is worth 1,000 words sometimes, I guess.
What do you think? What do you think his captain catchphrase was? What do you think?
You know,
like,
I was thinking,
let's fucking do this.
Yeah, I like it. It ought to be something. Like, it needs to be something that conveys urgency. I mean, like Lorca already has go, so yeah. I don't know.
You know, I feel like kind of an old school, like, let's move. You know, kind of like a little insistent, maybe a little almost naggy, a little something like that. I think I could see that something like that from him.
Yeah. Aaron has pointed out that'd be the one thing Roddenberry would be upset about. No zippers in the future. yeah, that would. I guess that is weird that zippers make a return in the 32nd century. But
Fathery, I've got my formal suggestion for what his catchphrase
all right,
should
what
be.
Do we got?
If he does it, make it happen. A little bit grumpy. Make it happen.
All right. I like it. If
I feel like it would fit him. I like you, I don't want them to all have to do that. I'm just saying.
I've accepted it. That's just a thing. That's just like a thing. Like, it's and Starfleet and
an
Starfleet.
Unspoken naval tradition for them,
yeah,
sort
it's
of.
A tradition. It's a culturally understood that many captains have a catchphrase to go to warp. That's canon now. It's been established in enough shows over enough years. Like, it's not my preference, but I'm going to be a grown up and accept it.
That's very mature of you. If Rayner can grow, so can you, Fathery. but yeah, that was a great ending. I love when these shows can end in a sequence that energizes me.
Yeah.
Sometimes occasionally in past Discovery seasons, there's enough B plots or C plots going on that they do a little catch up at the end, and I'm a little tired kind of by the end of it. I'm a little, you know, maybe plot exhausted or something like that. And, you know, finding out that, you know, the 10C or the DMA or whatever has moved to a different location of the galaxy and threatened somebody doesn't really quite do it for me. But something that I feel is like moving a plot forward where you've got this a character with some real momentum to him and a personality that I'm starting to like, that's a great ending.
And we're not meant to anticipate explanations. We're meant to anticipate seeing the next event. And I think that makes a huge difference. I think that's the biggest key in why this season feels different.
Yeah, that's a good point there, Father. I want to see the interactions that will develop and stuff, but I'm not like worried about, oh, I hope the big reveal doesn't suck.
my final thought on this episode before going into the Gornegg section of the show, we'll cover Gornegg's for both episodes, but my final thought is The ending of both these episodes that made me like really excited. A big part of that was also, I think, Jeff Russo's score that then plays into the end credits.
That was one of the things that I wanted to talk about too.
Yeah, and I said last week when we were maybe a couple weeks ago, we were talking about like the things we've liked over all of Discovery. I've always appreciated Jeff Russo's music a lot more than I don't see other people like praise it as much as I do. So maybe it's just like my personal preference. The notes that he picks to put together, they just make my brain feel good or whatever. But I've always dug his stuff, but this season has been so far, I think because he's doing things he doesn't typically do, like they are trying to do like more playful stuff with the music and things that a lot of times it kind of gives a feeling of that, like that awe factor of like,
right,
like, oh, look at like this grand thing that's gonna like unfold before, you know. It really helps elevate the scale. It makes everything feel like it's just a little bit more epic.
I feel like there's a bit of sweep to it, especially like when you're doing the planetary surfaces and stuff. I was thinking about composers like I don't know how you say his name, it's a French name, Maurice Jarre, the guy who did Lawrence of Arabia. Not just the biggest themes of that, but the kind of the building themes. We're really famous, very influential. Anybody who kind of does those sort of Eastern themes and wants to try and get an Arabic theme, that one is often something they turn to. But Jerry Goldsmith, too, for like stuff he did in like The Mummy or The 13th Warrior. And
is the music from Maltese Falcon? Do you remember anything? Like, I don't know who composed it or anything.
It's been too long since I've seen it, but I think there's a few moments of it I remember that do have that, because they want to suggest, you know, that MacGuffin, the sort of the power and behind it, and the sense of destiny and people's fates entwined in it,
like so big, mysterious, epic, ancient things.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I agree. You know, Father, I'm a music guy. I like a lot of film scores and things like that. And I think I usually think Discovery's music is solid, but it doesn't necessarily elevate itself a ton for me. But I think in this season, because I think they're letting him kind of indulge himself and kind of, you know, cut loose a little bit more with slightly more romantic sweep to it. I think it is standing out for me.
And Stephen Barton's music in Picard season 3, I remember like every episode when it would end and it would cut to like those beautiful like end credits that had like the Mike Okuda L cars. But when it would play like Steve, well, I guess then it actually did like some Jerry Goldsmith stuff from First Contact. But when there was like a motif that would play a lot at like the end of episodes of Picard when they'd kind of like go into that. And I don't know, so many of those episodes ended of like, I knew it was going to be the final season of that show and maybe the last time I saw those characters or at least see them together, and it made me like really cherish each and every episode and really look forward to the next one. And I like that both these episodes ended on that kind of note for me, and I would love to see more of that in this season, and hopefully a very satisfying finale at the end.
I agree. I don't think I have anything really more to say to that. I think the main thought takeaway I want to say is that yes, if they can continue to do endings like they've been doing, then like I love like a good ending will like almost like essentially bump up something by a star if I was rating it with star ratings.
Or bump
of that,
it down
please.
With a shitty ending.
I guess that's true, yes.
But if that's all we got, then we'll just go ahead and go into the Gorn Egg section of the show. So if you're new to Text Trek, this is when we like to talk about the Easter eggs, end jokes, and continuity connections that we thought were worth bringing up. But there's quite a few in these two episodes. So we'll start with Red Directive. In the beginning at the Federation Millennium Party, they're drinking Tonic 2161. That is the year of the Federation founding, as was shown in Star Trek Enterprise series finale, These Are the Voyages. And I think it's interesting that they said that the drink tastes like Jamja sticks. Like, mm-hmm. Nog and Jake were always eating on the promenade in Deep Space Nine. Because when I heard that, I assumed, like, oh, cool, I would like that drink. And then I was like, why do I think I would like it? Because it tastes like Jamja sticks. I have no idea what a Jamja stick tastes like. I just assume I would like it because it's from Deep Space Nine. It's like, I like Jamja sticks, even though, like, I've never tasted one.
It's like cinnamon and cocoa. I just made that up. Maybe.
Actually, Ciroc Lofton said they were terrible because it just tasted like flavorless gelatin.
And oh,
it
was, wow. Yeah, yeah.
It was hard acting to pretend to enjoy it. I mentioned that I liked Tarina's mentions of the Tholians and Breen, but yeah, she actually establishes that we have a Tholian Republic and a Breen Imperium in the 32nd century. So they've had some rearrangements. They used to be the Tholian Assembly and the Breen Confederacy. So now they're a Republic and an Imperium. But I'm glad that these weird ass aliens are still you know, like the weirdos, the weird mysterious creatures, they're still thriving in the 32nd century. You know, the Tholians aren't humanoid, so I wonder if they come into play. You know, you gotta think, are they gonna be like the Chase? Are we eventually gonna have like other people are gonna be chasing after this? I think it's not just gonna be Maul and Locke versus Starfleet. So
yeah.
And the Breen. I heard an interesting theory. Maybe Locke is a Breen. Maybe that's what they look like under their helmets. You know, no one's ever seen one, so I don't want to reveal the Breen. That's like revealing Kovich's mysteries, though. Like, do you really want to show an unmasked Breen?
I mean, if you've got a good story,
you can never
to
put
tell.
The mask back on. It can never go back on.
That's true. That's true. But then again, the Breen are also a little bit boring as a result of not being able to get any sort of deeper on them. So, did they say, by the way, Father, that there's infighting going on for leadership?
Yeah. The Breen were infighting, but also the Orions, I think.
Maybe shit. Yeah, no, I'm not sure.
Looking for a new leader. What else we got? Red Directive. We've never heard of that before, but I don't know. Apparently it happens on occasion because Rainer says he's ran point on four of them. But it was very similar to the Omega Directive, where I guess, like, oh, drop whatever you're doing. Here's a Starfleet protocol to go do this thing. You have to do it right now. Kind of similar to that. The Romulan science ship was really cool to see. It looks very much like the Romulan science ship we saw in the Next Generation episode, The Next Phase. And most of the Romulan stuff in general looked perfect. The only thing that I would have done different was like the interior of the ship. It was obviously disco interiors redressed, which they could have done. Like, at least go across the street to the Strange New World sets and, like, redress those so it looks like, a little less obvious what you did, but not a huge deal. The Antares, I thought, was a cool name for a ship. That goes all the way back to Charlie X. There was an Antares there that dropped off Charlie with the Enterprise. But there's also an Antares mentioned in Deep Space Nine. And then Rainer himself, I thought he was going to be revealed to be a Romulan or a half-Romulan with those ears. But a few weeks ago, it did come out that he is actually from the Deep Space Nine episode Armageddon Games, that species.
Kelleran? Is that the race?
Kelleran.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kelleran. Yeah, but they were one of the two species that were disarming their weapons of mass destruction in that episode.
Okay.
A cool deep cut, though. Sometimes Discovery does that. So they'll just be like, hey, we're just going to randomly use this one-off alien. So I like it, though. And the Romulan mystery box I was talking about, that's actually a Tan Zikran, like we saw in Picard Season 1. So it looked a little different then, but kind of the same. I don't know, just like cool little... Hellraiser. It looks like the Hellraiser box thing.
They have the advanced one to stuff secrets in.
And I comment on like the Romulan uniforms looking good, but just the entire presentation of anything they brought over from the chase was handled with a lot of care and respect. So it's makes us happy to see that. Well done, Discovery. And then our android Fred, they point out that he is a Alton Soong type style. So Alton Soong, I know we've had like so many Soongs over the years. He was the Soong running around in Picard Season 1 on Coppelius, who's building like that society of synths there. But it sounds like this guy Fred, he came along at some point later in maybe the 26th century, but built on kind of like that same Alton Soong style. So, but I don't know. We might learn more of Fred if he is robotically resurrected, as I suspect he will be in the coming weeks. And there's also some other cool stuff in Fred's shop or whatever. It's kind of like a pawn shop, or I don't know what the hell was it. It was like a collector's room, or he buying things to like hawk them off to other people?
Or? Yeah, I think he's a fence.
Okay. Yeah, they established that. Okay, so that's what he's doing. But he had, like, a lot of, like, cool decorations and, like, old vintage stuff. He had, like, a Season 1 Batleth. And we see Locke gives him a bunch of Picard props that no one's using anymore. And also a self-sealing stim vault from Deep Space Nine. You see the cloaking device. It's, like, the prop from Picard. So someone had to put that on a truck and drive it from L.A. to Toronto. I want to be the guy who, like, drives the cloaking device cross-country. For Paramount, if next time they have to do that, I'll do it. I'll drive it for free.
You have to carry it like.
Can you cloak the truck? Would it turn the truck invisible? That'd be dangerous. That'd be a hazard on the road.
Fathery, I need Ram and Quark to smuggle it out. It's got to be them. Weren't they the ones?
Yeah, they
sneaking into Cisco's cabin.
They stole Martok's cloaking device.
Yeah.
To go to the Mirror Universe.
So good.
Yeah, it was good. The Vulcan proposal that Tarina gave Saru, we know that it is a Vulcan custom for the women to propose to the men.
All right.
Or at least it would appear to be, based on the very formal, presented as like the traditional style of doing it, proposal engagement we got with T'Pring and Spock in Strange New Worlds, Season 1, Episode 1. And then the episode Red Directive was dedicated to JP. It ended with for JP with love. That was actually a cameraman, JP Lockerer, I believe was how you say his name. He worked on seasons 2 and 3 of Discovery, as well as Short Treks. And that's all I got for Red Directive. On Under the Twin Moons, we get a mention of the Starfleet Corps of Engineers. That was cool to hear. I guess they're still around in the 32nd century. The Promelian race, that was another great use of the universe. The Promelians, or Promelians? I think that's how you say it. Promelians. The Promelians were established in the TNG episode Booby Trap. But yeah, they were supposed to be incredibly advanced and then tragically went to war in this really big, long-lasting war, and they're all extinct now. And they had all these cool battleships and all these cool relics that are like floating around. And Picard is a little boy. He's like a little ship nerd boy. And he was always like, you know, reading about like cool ships and playing with model ships. And he was really into the Promelians. And they had like some of the best ships ever.
What a dad thing.
Yeah. It's like the dad watching, you know, watching the History Channel and like looking like old World War II ships or something.
You know, Picard went back to his cabin and watched NCIS.
Well, he would be of that generation, I guess, whatever the equivalent is. You know, it's weird that like Rainer is like so young. Like a Zoomer is like a great 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 grandfather of Rainer's generation. And so when he's saying like for the win, 70% for the win, it's like, man, that's like some like old school slang. That's like some old school 21st century jargon you're busting out, Rainer. You know, you'd think he'd be like the whippersnapper, like some like new 32nd century stuff. Like how Maul and Locke talked.
He's going to try and get that Riz, fathery. It's short for charisma. It's what the kids are saying now.
I can't handle
it,
that.
They're calling it Riz. It's out there.
I'd rather talk about the Shipon, the Romulan false door from Picard. Oh, I thought that was cool. Glad to see it brought back in Discovery. They do a good job on Discovery of like, they always mention like the other shows that are, they always have those little connections. And I thought it was a fun use of the universe to be like, oh, the clue is going to send you to the planet where there's memories are shared, you know, thoughts are shared. There's some type of like weird brain connection. And the water is also a weird color. You know, the way it was with the opaline sea. Is that how you say that?
Probably. Yeah.
I don't like, I thought like opal was like purple, but what color is opal?
I've got a few things where I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, but I know like the ocean on Trill is supposed to be purple, and like the ocean on Beta Z is supposed to be green. But we never really see either of them look like that. But I don't know. It was just cool use of the universe. If you're like, oh, what's like a Star Trek riddle? It's like, oh, what are planets where the ocean is like this, you know, weird, mysterious color? But you also have like the thoughts shared. I thought that was just neat. Oh yeah, that would make sense for Beta Z or Trill.
Yeah, good riddling.
And opal's a mix of color, I guess. So it can be green, purple, whatever. So, and then Rainer had some really cool accommodations that he had earned, I guess, over the course of his career. But the best one was the Grand Kite Order of Tactics, which was something that Captain Kirk had, and it was kind of like something that was kind of like unique to Kirk in canonical Star Trek. They hadn't really like given that to anyone else until Picard came along, and then like the prop department threw in Picard has like that trophy somewhere, and Shaw also has a Grand Kite Order of Tactics. So I guess it's not as unique to Kirk as I used to think. Kirk, Picard, Shaw, and now Rainer all got the Grand Kite Order of Tactics, whatever the hell that means.
Sounds like he's been in some battles.
That's all I got on the Gornags, but Dave and I do like to receive subspace transmissions. We love hearing what people out there think about these episodes, so please share your thoughts with us. Please comment on YouTube. Let us know what you thought about these episodes. Please join our Discord server and be part of the conversation over there. You can also reply to my tweets. I ask people, what do they think about these episodes? And we will try to share some of that next week. We were going to try to have our friend Captain Pikachu on the show last week when we were talking about the things we wanted to see this season, and she wasn't able to make it. But we actually received what she would have mentioned to us had she been here, like her list of things she wanted to see in season 5 and then one thing she didn't want to see. So I'm going to just run through that real quick now as our subspace transmission segment for this week. But
let's see if anything came true.
Yeah, so with just two episodes, but from Captain Pikachu, her top three things. I guess I'll start at the bottom. 3, more exploration of the state of the galaxy post-burn and rebuilding the Federation. There's talk of that. We might see more of it coming soon. 2, more pairing up characters who haven't previously interacted as much to explore new dynamics.
I feel like Culber and Book and things like that, that's happening.
But they had their scenes in season 4. They kind of established a Book-Culber relationship and a book Stamets relationship. So I think that.
Well, then I guess we're going to need to see Rainer and Linus. That's what it has to be.
That's the combination I want for sure. And people who follow Captain Pikachu on Twitter know that she's very concerned about the state of occupational safety in the Star Trek future. And does OSHA still exist? Her number one thing she wants to see is seatbelts, because safety is king, as she explains. And Captain Pikachu says the thing that she does not want to see is an unsatisfying and abrupt ending that leaves too many plot threads unanswered. So hopefully they wrap everything up. I think they're likely to, though. So we'll find out.
Their odds seem better than usual this season. Sometimes I get a pretty kind of a pit in my stomach, Red Angel and such, Control. And here they've already revealed one of the big reveals. So yeah, good stuff. Well, solid shot.
In a few weeks, it'll all be over. So we'll know how it ended. But looking forward to that episode 3 next week. And oh, I need to read the little teasery thing I said I would read that Michelle Paradise gave us. So, what does Michelle say about next week? Michelle Paradise says next week, episode 3, Janal, name of the episode. Colbert, like you've never seen him before, according to Michelle Paradise. So, I will leave you all on that.
That's some Riddler shit.
looking forward to talking about that. And until then, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.